wrote Excalibur Briefing. It is now out of print, but I have to tell you, it's one of my most favorite books. It's so dog-eared that I'm eager for him to reprint it. He has just gotten the rights back to that so he can republish it. And those of you who were lucky enough to get a copy of his book that we had at the back of the room and had him autograph that, that's going to be a treasure for you too. He's really a nuclear engineer. We kind of thought maybe he was a physicist from all of his statements and research, but he isn't. He is retired military, and he has spent a lot of time and is a persistent researcher in alternate energy, which is better known as free energy. And he has a group of individuals, about 8 researchers, I believe, who are working with him, 8 scientists. He's a leading advocate of scalar potential electromagnetics and force-free redefinition of mass. I really didn't know what that meant when I read force-free. You know, they use all these terms, kind of put them together, and if you don't really understand the context, then sometimes it gets a little mysterious. But that just means that you're forcing something when it's not really necessary, as I understand it. He may change it, but that's what makes sense to me. He's president and CEO of C-Tech, Inc. He has advanced a mechanism of the electromagnetism producing a vacuum engine, as well as the interaction of electromagnetic fields and radiation with biological systems. He's president of the Association of Distinguished American Scientists, and his latest work, which we had here, was dealing with therapeutics. He's written Analysis of Scalar Wave Technologies, which is also out of print. Most of his things are out of print. So we're hoping that he's going to put them back so that we can all have the advantage of his vast wisdom. I tell the funny story about how I had called Tom Bearden to invite him for several times over the last 5 years to invite him to come, and he's always been so busy doing all these different projects that he could never make it. But this time, he accepted the invitation, and I cannot tell you how joyous this experience has been. Join me in welcoming Thomas E. Bearden.
Thank you, Elaine. And thank all of you for coming. If there's a real hope for America, it really is people who are a little bit more forward-looking and who don't necessarily cotton to all the propaganda that we are so besieged with these days. Speaking of bureaucratic systems and propaganda, you know, the book here says you got to get in a little joke at the front. Reminds me of my friend Pierre discussing propaganda with me, my Cajun friend down in South Louisiana. I'm a Yankee. I'm from North Louisiana. But I love the Cajun people because they have such a great sense of humor. They're the finest people on earth. So I asked Pierre, well, what's your definition of bureaucracy? He said, well, it's like some insurance policy I got there, you know. He says, the other week there I was in the hospital and I was plumb sick. So I call up my insurance adjustment agents there and I bring him over and he said, okay, boy, I got some good news for you, got some bad news for you. I say, okay, what the good news? He said, well, Pierre, the good news is you got the best insurance policy in this whole United States of America. It pay off every time, no questions, and it pay full amount. And I said, man, that's great. That's what I need. I'm broke. He said, but Pierre, I got some bad news for you. And he said, yeah, what that? He said, well, it's one of them group policy, and the whole damn group got to get sick for it pay. Sometimes I think the propaganda we get so besieged with is one of those group insurance policies, you know, where they really, you can't read the fine print. You can't really find out what the devil it is they're saying or talking about. There's even a little bit of that in science, and we're trying to strip away a little bit of that from some of the science, particularly about energy systems and medical applications of an extended electrodynamics and some changes we think are in store for the human species. This is a basic thing we're continuing from yesterday, and if I can have the next slide. We're kind of paraphrasing Churchill, and I'm sure all of you remember this famous comment he made in World War II when the British, it was now apparent the British were going to survive, and the Germans were not going to be able to invade England after all and storm it. He said in he didn't say in technology, I'm paraphrasing him, but to paraphrase his famous statement, in our technology today, I think we have reached the end of the beginning. And I think we're just now entering the beginning of the end. Now, of course, not the only person that thinks that, but I'll try to give you a little bit more insight into it. Next slide, please. Let's go right rapidly through over unity systems. They are permitted by Maxwell's equations before you regauge them symmetrically. That's a totally arbitrary procedure. It has no basis or requirement in nature. It was done by man simply to make the resulting equations easy to solve. So if you change the system, which is difficult to solve, to a new system that's easy to solve, and then you say, but it's the same system. It is not. They changed the energy twice. They rigged it so that the two forces, free forces that appear, which you could use to do work with, are exactly equal and opposite, and they selected only those systems and none others. And that's the electromagnetics we teach all our engineers. It's been forcibly keel-hauled, the system has, into local equilibrium. So we can never go over unity. Classical thermal applies, and you can't beat the second law. But you don't have to do that. Nature does not require you to symmetrically regauge those equations. If you asymmetrically regauge, the electrodynamicists tell you already, you can freely change the system of any the energy of any system anytime you wish. It's called regauging. Simply change the voltage. In theory, for a perfect system, it doesn't cost you anything. How much energy can you get by doing that? How much would you like? From any voltage, any scalar potential, no matter how small, take 1 microvolt. You can extract as much energy as you wish without limit. The formula is VQ, or VQ if you prefer that, and it depends on how many charges you got for the potential to pour energy across and over onto, to collect the energy that's flowing like an unending river from voltage. Voltage is a series of unending rivers. Whitaker, 1903. So you can take 1 flashlight battery, and if you could collect the energy from it, you could power an entire fleet of battleships. That is standard electrodynamics. That's not Tom Bearden. That's just VQ. W equals VQ, the most elementary work energy theorem there is. But anyway, let's go ahead and see what we can do with this if we decide we're actually going to believe that stuff, and we're going to gather some of that energy in our systems. And we're not going to be so stupid that we ram the spin electrons back through the dipole and kill it. Next slide, please. Why don't our systems do free energy? Every one of our systems we build today is a free energy system. Neither the battery nor generator furnishes any energy to the system. None. Zilch. Did anybody hear me? Batteries don't furnish energy to the system. The source dipole, the simple separation of charges, furnishes all the energy. That's been known in particle physics for 40 years. Never made it into electrodynamics. Electrodynamics would have you believe that all the charges are perpetual motion machines. They create all the energy in their fields and potentials out of nothing. So, since they often accuse us free energy researchers of being perpetual motion nuts, my reply to that is, in our wildest imagination, we couldn't compare it to you. Because the electrodynamicists assume that every damn charge in the universe is a perpetual motion machine, and they teach that to all the universities and to all the students. So when they get around the problem of the source charge and go read the solution to that that's been known both theoretically and experimentally for 40 years in particle physics, actually the charge extracts the energy from the vacuum. Remember how the prevailing thing is, we need to know how to get energy from the vacuum. Guess what? After 40 or 50 years of clear experimental proof that the vacuum is very energetic, highly energetic, unbelievably energetic, the U.S. Patent Office finally has accepted it. They've issued patents now recognizing the common vacuum as a source of energy. So now I don't have to argue about that one anymore, because the U.S. Patent Office will accept that part of the patent. But here's why our systems don't produce over unity energy. They're all free energy systems. Look at this little diagram here, and I've got a very simple circuit of a battery powering some resistors. Well, what happens is the upper part of the potential, the upper line going to the right there, is the one that potentializes all the electrons. Those electrons have extra energy on them, and so boy, they are vibrating, and there's a little more energy on the back part than the front part, and so that's an E field, and it shoves them down through the resistors and scatters the little potential on them as heat and energy and so forth. And when they get down to the bottom line, they don't have any extra energy on them now. They're just sitting there, so to speak, like a lump of dirt, like a clump of clay. And meanwhile, all the other guys that you're getting the energy collected off on the front top line from the energy that's pouring down that circuit from that source dipole in the battery, just pouring right freely out of the vacuum, in fact, fills all the space around the circuit. Now you have to use half of that energy to force those spent electrons back up through the backside on the left, back up through the battery, back through your source dipole, and knock the hell out of the source dipole. Knock the charges right out of there. So you kill the goose that's giving you the energy. If you had a gusher, it would be like you went out in an oil well and capped the well. So, fools that we are, since we design our circuits that way, we have to then... The battery then has to do some more chemical reaction to force those charges back apart. This is where the battery work furnishes energy to do that work, to re-separate the charge. It doesn't furnish anything to the circuit. Doesn't furnish current, doesn't furnish energy. What it really does is restores the dipole. Once these charges are separated, you've got energy pouring down the circuit right out of the vacuum again, and of course, we keep driving the electrons back through, banging up the source dipole, and we have to keep using our chemical energy to restore it. And when all the chemical energy is changed, we got to stop, recharge the battery so we can change the chemistry back. We train electrical engineers. We don't have any energy engineers. We have energy killers. We haven't ever trained, in the history of this country, an energy engineer. We have trained gobs of energy killing engineers, source killers. Now in a generator, what do? I burn a little fuel, rotate the shaft a little bit, make a magnetic field, and a magnetic field goes in, and one charge goes one way and the opposite charge goes the other way, and it separates the charges. It gives me my dipole. The only thing I do in burning the energy is form the dipole. The energy you burn to rotate the shaft doesn't furnish anything to the circuit. Sorry about that, but it's true. If you don't believe it, check your textbook. Check it real closely. Well, what happens is we do the same stunt. The power company, fools that they are, run a ground return line right back to their generator, and they pump all those spinning electrons right back up through the back EMF of the generator, knock the whackus out of the separated charges. So I got to burn a little more fuel, they have, rotate shaft a little more, make another magnetic field, force the charges back apart. Whereupon, as the energy flows and collection starts to do work, it also kills the source. It's like you built a water wheel, and you connected a pulley out on the end of it, and up there where you got your gate swinging out in the river to divert the water down across your water wheel and power your mill, fools that we are, we connect this pulley on the end with a steel cable up to the pulley up there by the gate, so that every time the water wheel starts to move, we start to tighten up the pulley and close the gate. Well, after the gate closed, we got to go back up and force back open the gate and do work on the gate. So all the while the wheel's rolling around the mill, we're up there steadily shoving the gate. That's the way we build every electric system we've ever built in this country. And that's what we train our electrical engineers to do. You pay the power company to have a giant sumo wrestling match inside its own generators. Boy, and these people call me a fool? I can't think of anything more ridiculous than to have a wrestling match inside your generator and pay for it. But that's what you pay for, and that's what I pay for, and that's what your power meter's measuring. It's not measuring the energy goes to feed your home. It's measuring how much they're having to do to restore the dipole back in their own generators that they're killing. That's how stupid our power engineering science is in this country. Next slide, please. Can you build a free energy generator? Of course, here's one you build for 25 cents. Take your permanent magnet. It's already a free energy generator. Go to particle physics. It's a dipole. Any dipole extracts energy from the vacuum, pours it out freely forever to the ends of the universe. Can I prove that? Sure. I'm going to stay in ordinary electrodynamics. I'm going to prove that. I'm going to do a little Gedanken experiment. Right now, that permanent magnet, let's say it's not magnetized. So it's not, we don't have a dipole, no excess charge anywhere. It's just sitting there inert. And suddenly, since this is a Gedanken experiment, I can play God. Bingo, I suddenly turn a switch and bingo, a magnet appears. Well, that field doesn't yet reach across the universe. But it's moving out now at the speed of light. Everybody agrees with that. That's what the conventional scientists say. If you suddenly produce this magnetic dipole, out from that goes the field. Well, that field is full of energy, field energy. And it's moving all the time and increasing the volume all the time. And the energy pouring out has to be increasing all the time, does it not? Because it's filling now a greater and greater and greater volume all around this thing. How long will that continue? How long you got to wait? That thing will sit there and pour out the energy, filling that whole field up to the end of the universe. And by the way, all the energy that's in any finite amount here that's already been filled, that energy is continually moving on, and the other energy is moving in. So pick yourself a volume, decide how much energy is in it, decide how long in seconds it takes to fill that volume. And that much energy every second is coming out of that cotton-picking permanent magnet right out of the vacuum. And that's standard garden-variety electrodynamics. That's not even Tom Bearden. Well, then why didn't our professors teach us that? Why did they tell us I got energy flowing but you can't use it? Nonsense. If I've got energy flowing and I don't know how to use it, it means I have a problem to figure out how to collect it and use it, how to bucket it in the river and use water. They just didn't give me a bucket, that's all. It's up to me to figure out how to get the bucket. Next slide. But anyway, cross a capacitor over it if you want a good one. And the common theory tells you E cross H is now non-zero, and the cross capacitor over a permanent magnet or electret laid across it will produce energy from now on, free. And every textbook will agree with that, so will every college professor. He'll come right back and say, but you fool you, you can't use it. No. That means us fools have deliberately decided not to figure out how to use it. Way back, we've had free energy devices since, in the old phrase, and I don't mean to offend anybody, Christ was a corporal. Everything we ever built was a free energy device in the first place. We just kept killing the source. Well, T. Henry Moray found out how to do it. He was a great pioneer. He demonstrated this device hundreds of times to all kinds of engineers and physicists and scientists of all kinds. He worked with the REA, he worked with the FBI, he had agents and double agents on him every which way. They tried to kill him. They fired at him from the shadows as he drove in a bulletproof car in Salt Lake City, Utah. Russians tried to kidnap him and get him back. You know, big long story. It's all true. Man was a great pioneer. He can never convince the system. He had 50 kilowatts coming out of this 55-pound device right out of thin air. Demonstrated it hundreds of times. Never was able to do anything in his life with it. One of the great tragedies of American science is the loss of T. Henry Moray and the T. Henry Moray device without him being able to get that device out. But it happened. It would happen before World War II. In the 30s, he had 50 kilowatts of power coming out of a 55-pound device. Well, I think it was 28 or 29 tubes of his special tubes. So, a great pioneer, went right down the tube. Didn't make it. Next slide, please. Well, they tell you our scientists don't know about free energy. That's total nonsense. They just don't read the literature anymore. They get on a computer and it's not logged in what's in the literature in 1938 and 39. You ought to try looking the old-fashioned way. You know where you take a paper and you run the references back and you run the references in that and backtrack it? The painful, agonizing way that we used to do research before we had all these marvelous computers. Don't want to go back to the 70s and cut off what happened in the 30s. Well, the Russians had them. They had a whole physics institute that had them. They're printed in the Russian physics literature, paper after paper after paper. They're documented, the theory, the pictures, everything is in the Russian literature and in the French literature before World War II. Why in the hell don't we read the papers? I don't know. Nobody goes back that far. They go back to the 70s because I can punch it in my computer and get it right out and get on with it, and everybody forgot about this. The work is there. If you don't believe it, go look. Next slide, please. Have we ever done it? You bet your bottom dollar. Stanford University, well, one of the greatest electrical scientists that this country ever produced, if he wasn't the greatest, was Gabriel Krohn, who worked for GE. A Navy contract with a GE that didn't have digital computers. They used a large analog computing arrangement simulator called the Network Analyzer. Gabriel Krohn states, he's a man that applied full general relativity to electrodynamics and rotating machinery. Gabriel Krohn, who's widely published, go get his papers and read them, states point blank that he created a true negative resistor. They had three of them. A positive resistor takes in energy, it's organized, and scatters it. A negative resistor gathers up all the scattering energy around and concentrates its organized energy down the circuit. So it's a free energy device. That's all a negative resistor is, a true one. Yes? Yes, I'm going to cover that. So what he did is, he says, and he says in black and white in published papers in the literature, that when you connect one of these negative resistors into the network analyzer, you can disconnect the generator because you no longer need it. The negative resistor will power the whole damn simulator. He says then, however, most people don't have a negative resistor, so you can use a charged capacitor as the source, but then you've got to keep the generator connected to keep charging the capacitor. If you don't believe it, go check the literature. Next slide, please. Well, I want to give you a scheme for how you can do free energy. Those that sat in here yesterday, I showed you that the energy that a circuit puts out is really about 10 to the 13th times as much as we are trained to calculate, because Lorentz taught everybody how to throw all the rest away. But all space around the circuit is filled with free energy flowing, wasted, non-divergent. That means it ain't caught and diverged into the circuit to be used. Well, a dumb country boy like me would say, if you've got lots of that energy all around that circuit, you got so much more than you got in the circuits you catching, you ought to have some more catcher's mitts, boy. You ought to be catching a few more of that stuff. So the problem, we've never had a problem with energy. We've got a Department of Energy that says the greatest problem we'll ever have is trying to learn how to extract energy from the vacuum. My Lord, everything extracts energy from the vacuum. It's the simplest thing there ever was. They ought to go read particle physics. They ought to read their own textbooks for 40 years. Every charge does it for free anyway. But anyway, if you take a circuit, a little source over here, a dipole, and it can be a battery generator, I don't care what it is, as long as it's producing something, and you run it over to what I'm going to call a bridge. Now, I'm going to define this mystical magic demon called a bridge. By definition, a bridge will pass the energy flow. Won't bother that. But it won't allow any DQDT, any ordinary current flow, because current flow is always associated with a part that's dissipating. So by definition, all a bridge does on the left side, it will pass the energy flow, but won't let any more current connect across there, so it doesn't have a field connection. Magnetic field is based on the current, you see. So this bridge does not allow electric fields from the left side to bridge over to the right side like your normal transformer does. But it will pass the energy flow. That's the definition. Whatever will do that is a bridge. Now, over on the right side, clever devils that we are, we catch that energy, put a lot of Q over there so we can get a lot of current and we can get a lot of power. We want dissipation here.
We want to catch a lot of energy, and we want to use, dissipate a lot, scatter it in the load. Well, we've got a problem. We've got the problem that if we want to build one of those closed circuits, you don't have to build a closed-loop circuit, by the way. It's not the only circuit in the world, but since everybody wants to do that, okay. If you're going to use a closed-loop circuit, you're going to have to put over on the right side of the bridge, you're going to have to put a time-reverse zone. What the hell this dumb Cajun saying? Well, otherwise, you've got a problem that down on the bottom end of the bridge on the right, you're looking up against the back EMF on that side, and half of whatever you got there is going to kill the dipole if you forcibly ram the electrons up there. You hadn't done nothing a normal transformer don't do. So if you just put a transformer in there, everybody knows, every fool knows that won't go over unity. But if you put a transformer in there, and this your college professor and your transformer designer did not tell you, and I'm not going to tell you how to do it, I'm still fighting for the patent on that one, but if you put in that area on the right side a time-reversed zone, I'll tell you something about that later, in a time-reversed zone, your professor forgot to tell you something. Current doesn't always move with minus del phi. In a time-positive zone, it does, but in a time-reversed zone, it moves exactly the other direction. And if you want current to move against the voltage drop, you have to have a time-reversed zone, or you have to brute force ram it from outside. Since we're not going to brute force ram it, we only got one choice left, time reverse zone. So if I can cause a little time reversal over on the right side of that bridge, every spent electron at the bottom of that bridge is going to get himself off, and he's going to kick off like mad and head out for the top against the voltage. As I see from outside in positive time, to him, he's doing exactly right because his time is reversed. He's falling downhill. I think he's climbing uphill. If I can do that, then that thing will run. I can furnish the energy from very little expenditure over on the left. In the theoretical case, it wouldn't cost me anything. In the real case, you got to pay a little bit. It does cost a little to switch and to vibrate, and you lose a little in the circuit. But you don't lose very much. And you can power whatever you wish on the right. Absolutely legitimate, and by the way, it's permissible. It's permissible both by Newton, by Maxwell's equations, and it's permissible by thermodynamics. Not classical thermodynamics. Nobody said that. I have an open system on the right. The right circuit is an open system freely receiving excess energy from an external source, the left circuit. Now that defines a different kind of thermodynamics. It's called the thermodynamics of open dissipative systems. And in that thermodynamics, the right side is permitted to, one, self-oscillate, two, self-power itself, and three, power the load and power itself at the same time, taking all the energy from what I'm furnishing it from the left. I haven't violated thermodynamics. I have not violated the laws of physics. I have not violated Maxwell's equations, but I darn sure violated them stereotyped electrodynamics they've been teaching all our power engineers. Next slide, please. You can do it with magnetics. This is Johnson's motor. And by the way, I have personally tested a Johnson rotary motor. It would have long since been on the market had his laboratory not been entered. And that set of magnets that he had finally achieved to do a magnet motor that rotated itself been stolen. Oh yes, that magic C word that we never use. You betcha, it's alive and well. In Virginia as well as down in Alabama. But basically what you do, again, the key is time reversal. If you create the right phase conjugation as this thing is going through, what I show is my rotor being attracted in, the north is being attracted into two south poles, and just as beginning to enter in and start to drag back, I create a time reversal zone, and so it actually expels it on through, unlike charges repel in negative time. He'll kick it right out of there. And Johnson has patented gates. These are patents issued which do exactly that. Johnson is very close at the moment to a rotary demonstration motor. I've been working for Johnson for over a decade and we do hope to bring it in very soon. That's all I can say about that. Except I want to show you one more slide. I think I have it included. Yes, there is another process where as it goes through, we can make that other... Johnson, not me, can, he's the inventor, can make that other magnet suddenly issue a very powerful force, a pulse. Doesn't cost you anything. And that force can be up to 10,000 times the strength of the normal magnetic pole you have there. Now, does anybody doubt that given that effect and control of it, you can make a magnetic motor that runs itself? Then you ought not to be. I will tell you, that force is in the literature if you know where to look for, but you will really have some looking to find it. There no longer are magnetics engineers except by just a very few schools in the United States, two or three. Normal electrical engineers never hear of magnetic engineering anymore. Most of them don't even know what a magnetic amplifier is anymore. Next slide, please. By the way, for those of you who think this is a simple job, from your normal electromagnetics training, there are 14 different kinds of magnetism. So when you start talking to me about magnetism, I'll ask you which kind you're discussing. If you're still thinking in terms of North and South Pole and that's all, then I'd say to you, go get a good magnetics materials textbook at the advanced level and read the thing. Find out about the 14 different kinds of magnetism. It's not a simple North Pole at all. This is a little device, a big device. It's running about 20 kW or so in Switzerland, has been running for some years, powering a religious commune. All kinds of people, physicists, scientists, engineers go in. It's a religious group, and they get together and they say, well, they have a meeting and they vote, and they say, well, the world's not ready for it, so they don't release it. But it's been working for over a decade. Next slide, please. Here's the thing right out of the standard textbook. There's my reference there. There are many other papers on this. It's a well-known effect. It always produces over unity energy. You can do it in any university lab to sophomore level. You take any particle exposed to an incident frequency of energy flow, and what you do is you cause that particle to have its particle resonance at the same frequency. The particle will be resonated by that frequency. It'll move a lot side to side and vibrate and quiver and shake and rattle and roll and all that, and what it'll do is gather in a lot more energy. Borin quotes here 12 times or 18 times as much. Hard literature, well-known effects, not Tom Bearden. 18 times. COP is 18. Everybody understand that figure? It takes out 18 times as much energy as you thought it was going to be able to get or as normal theory would predict. Next slide. Okay, here's one that's working. A well-known effect based on the Annie-Stokes emission phenomena. For 50 years, been documented, it's defined as over unity. You put in some energy into a medium, it always gives you out more than you put in. Been known for 50 years, well known, it's in the textbooks everywhere. Go look up Annie Stokes' emission if you think there is no over unity devices or machines or processes and all working out there. It's been working for 50 years. Then where are our wonderful Department of Energy folks trying to use Annie Stokes' emission to produce power systems? Zero. Wonder why they're working on all this oil stuff. Maybe get a little bit, another decimal point, efficiency in the combustion process. Why are they still working on big nuclear stuff? Big accelerators. Every little old circuit puts out 10 to the 13 times as much energy as we're gathering and using. Why don't we get some more? If we had a Department of Energy that had any forward thinking of all, that is the problem it would be working on. There is no energy problem. There is an energy collection and use problem without killing your dipole. This is the Lewandi experiment. What you do, there's three little drawings here. Take the leftmost drawing, the little blue thing. That's a little bitty sluggy spot in a little vial of water. That's all it is. It's just a little slug of water sitting in that vial, a little flask. And I take a little old bitty laser. First of all, I put some dye, some fluorescent dye in there, in that flask of water, and I fire a laser pulse into that dye. And just where that laser pulse strikes, that little volume of water is what I'm showing. Now there's a little warm orange glow around where that laser pulse hit there. The dye fluoresces. That's all that happens. Nothing spectacular at all. do this for $20 in any sophomore or certainly junior laboratory where you have a phase conjugate optics laboratory in any university in this country. Now I do one simple thing. I take out of my pocket some titanium dioxide particles. Now, titanium dioxide is the main ingredient in white paint. So it's cheap. Now, the only thing I did, I ran these through filters. I did my calculations for my particle resonant frequency to match the laser frequency. And I selected those particles, filtered down those particles that meet that size. That's all I did. And those are the particles I put in a little flask. And now I hit that thing with one laser pulse over here on the right. And what happens? I have this humongous blast of laser light, coherent light, that comes out and fills the whole room. From that one little old bitty pulse that created that little warm glow over there before. I get one whale of a lot more energy out of there than what I put in there. Now, Lettikoff, working with all this in 67, Lettikoff called that negative absorption. Ain't that a nice place? Only way could get through the dad blame sensors. He wanted to say excess emission. Oh, that violates conservation of energy. But negative absorption does not. You thought I was kidding about the propaganda joke, didn't you? Well, they got propaganda in science, too. So you can say negative absorption and negative resonance absorption, and they'll print your papers, and the literature has got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them in there already. And all that is, ladies and gentlemen, is excess emission and free energy. So is it known in regular science? You bet your bottom dollar. Do they call it that? Oh, hell no. Sure, hit it again, do exactly the same thing. Hit it 1,000 times more, do exactly the same thing. It's called lacing without population inversion. And Lawanda's got some very fine patents on it, too. Now, again, if we had a Department of Energy that's worth its salt, this is a guaranteed, verified, bona fide, certified, whatever else fied you want to, free energy device and an over unity system, why don't we make a power system out of that or some adaptation? Well, actually, a fella already has, and I'll get to that. Next slide, please. His name was Patterson. Now, he didn't use the little particles, and he used some stuff from cold fusion, which I'll get into very briefly. He takes palladium cladding, the best stuff he has, is palladium cladding around these little microspheres, and he had some older patents. He's one of the world's greatest guys at building little, nice, perfectly round microspheres. And so he clad these things with palladium because palladium has a magic characteristic. It scarfs up hydrogen in whatever form, deuterium, hydrogen ion, whatever, from the solution, and loads itself gradually with hydrogen. A positive charge is a time inversion. Ooh, boy, like the Cajuns say, I like that time reversal. That's negative entropy. That's what I'm looking for. That's retro-reflection. That's phase-conjugate reflection. All of these good terms mean the energy gets back together and orders itself again, and I can reuse that beast again. Well, what he does is the energy comes in, and it starts scattering every which way between all those little microspheres. And so it lingers a while, and it's retro-reflecting. They're optically active. And so it's doing ping-pong back and forth, and multiple retro-reflections every which way. Well, let's reason together. Take the volume of the microspheres. Take their energy flow that's present in the volume at a certain time. Now, if it flows through at the speed of light, and let's say for that volume at any one instant at the speed of light, I'd have, let's say real simple, 1 joule of energy in there, just to be easy. Suppose it lingered 10 times longer before it got through there. My energy density at any little cubic centimeter would be 10 times bigger, wouldn't it not? I'd have 10 times as much energy in there, although I'm only inputting the same rate at which I was inputting at the speed of light. The energy bunches up and gets denser. And in that device, that's more energy. That's called asymmetric self-regaging. It's where the system changes its own energy freely. Meanwhile, he's putting in the energy rate that he's inputting is the same load, and what's happening is now I have a much greater potential inside the thing. That's what regauging means, change the potential, change the energy of the system per charge. And what's happening is it's beginning to scatter out heat energy from that process. And when it finally reaches, when the palladium finally loads, which takes a while, you got to run about 13 hours to build it up, gradually loads up and gets this process going more and more, and then finally it's putting out somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 times as much energy out as you're putting in. Then when you cut the power input off, it runs another 13 hours before it dies down. Did you hear me? About 13 hours, an average unit like this will continue to run as it gradually drops its power level, and you're not inputting a damn thing. Okay, so can you do free energy? Of course you can. Now, the problem he has with that one, he can't keep the palladium cladding on his little microspheres. They come off after a couple of days and get beat up by the ion bombardment. And so he has to go to something like copper to hang in there tough enough. Well, it don't do the hydrogen loading nearly so much, so he's doing good to get 2 out of it, or 1.2 with ordinary metals. I suggest that the real problem here for a good project, a good research project, is to find out how to keep that palladium on there. Because then you've got yourself 1,000 or 1,200 times as much out as you got in. You got something very practical at that point. Next slide, please. There's a lady at University at Buffalo, New York, one of the fine lady scientists of this country, by the way, Professor Chung. She is the leading expert in America and possibly even in the entire Western world and maybe in the whole world in what is called today smart materials, where the materials themselves are used as electronics. She has a true negative resistor, which she announced publicly at a symposium. The paper has been written, I understand, and is in peer review now for publication. But basically what she reported was in her true negative resistor, the current is running against the voltage in the active process. What does that tell you? Her carbon filaments have created iterative phase conjugation and have created a time reversal zone. That's the only way you can get the current to run against the voltage. Otherwise, it runs the other way. And that's the basic requirement for building a conventional type free energy machine. That breaks the back EMF problem. So I think we will see coming out of that work probably an entire series of useful devices in the future based on carbon filament work, crossed carbon filaments. And she's the world expert in that entire area. Next slide, please. By the way, this thing has been tested for a year. All kinds of folks tested it, other scientists, no question that it's there. Okay, let's talk about something now that goes from this Earth on into astrophysics. Because we want to change the conservation of energy law, we're working our way towards that. And we want to include not just single pass energy collection, but multiple reflection energy collection, which presently does not appear in physics. They neglected that one in the energy conservation law. I've already revised the work energy theorem to account for this and published that, and I've now revised the conservation of energy law, and I hope that'll be published shortly. I'm going to do a Gedanken experiment up on the left. Now, in this Gedanken experiment, what I have, if I got this here pointer working, I got a little heater filament inside this cylinder, actually this sphere. And I have a little hole, of course, that I feed the thing. I neglect the hole and consider this thing is perfect. That's good enough for government work right now. And what I have is the inside of this cylinder, by definition, don't ask me how we do it, any way you want to do it, does some degree of phase conjugate reflection, retroreflection. Let's say 0.1. This means that if this inside wall gets hit with 100 watts, of input energy rate, if you were to collect it, would be watts. It's really not watts when it's energy flow, although they call it that. It's joules per second. What would happen is 10 watts, 1/10, would be returned precisely back to the heater for use again. If I fire one pulse in there and cut it off, it can be shown that if you have a retroreflectivity of 0.5, you get twice out, coming out through the walls that you put in. You can also show that if you go past 0.5, you go over unity. You also can show that if you put in anything steadily and you have any kind of retroreflection, it's an interesting divergent series that emerges. And in that divergent series, the energy density inside that chamber increases without bound, without limit. Now, in the real world, materials will start to buckle and melt and all kinds of things at some energy density level. They can only stand so much. But for a Gedanken experiment, we say, I play God, perfect materials. There is no limit to the amount of energy this can produce if you keep putting in a quarter watt. Eventually, you will have the other 9/10 passing out. You will be putting in a quarter watt, and you're getting a quarter watt out. Keep on putting in a quarter watt, and eventually you're getting 10 watts out. Keep on putting in a quarter watt, and eventually you're getting a megawatt out. How high would you like to go? If this thing will hold together and nothing break down, there is no limit. Now, in the real world, there is a limit. The materials do break down. They melt. They move. They change the configuration. They change the phase conjugate constant, all kinds of reflectivity constant, all kinds of things. Not a linear world. Well, but the cases vary as to where the materials break down. They don't all break down the same way. For example, the thing that we're using down with Patterson and so forth, we're down in a lower level, and we can go higher and higher in certain cases, and let's have the next slide to see what turns out. Very interesting thing emerges. Now, here's a whole set of experiments and things that show various energy levels that are at least candidates for this process. Nobody has ever even thought of applying this process to astrophysics, for example, because they use the single pass laws. They do not use the retroreflective, multiple retroreflective energy laws. They're using the old linear energy law. See, Stokes emission is less than one. Resonance Stokes emission is the name when it's exactly one. Any Stokes emission is named for greater than one. Patterson comes in, and Correa's tube comes in up here at 1,000 to 1,100. Part of the sun's energy output is due to this process I propose. This is a hypothesis, not nuclear reactions at all. And it comes in somewhere right about here. X-ray astronomical sources come in about up here at a higher energy density level. Gamma ray bursters come in right about here. All that means is that in this astronomical material, the material is holding a little longer before it gives enough to break the configuration. The longer it's just like a nuclear weapon. The longer it holds, the bigger the boom. If it holds long enough, the boom gets bigger. Well, I nominate this as the thing that's giving you gamma ray bursters, that's giving you para-annihilation radiation sources, that's giving you the galactic antimatter streamers, and whatever else is in the middle here I don't even know about. And with extreme rarity, if the energy density gets to a certain level before the actual material moves, it's possible that it ruptures four-dimensional space-time itself. And all that means is you blow out into n-dimensional space and you create another four-space universe. You don't destroy this universe at all. You just blow a little hole in the side, like blowing out a tire. Only you keep the air in here and you blow out this stuff into the next universe and create another universe. Now, nominate that for the Big Bang, or at least a Big Bang mechanism. But it's different from all the energy in the universe coming back together as a Big Bang and all this. This is a little blowout on the side. And I think that any universe does this process occasionally. It gives birth to other universe. After all, it's a living universe. It has to have some process to give birth. And this is it, I think. Anyway, as a hypothesis, we list this very interesting thing that I can fit that kind of a curve and I can nominate all of those things to fit it. Now, that doesn't prove it. It's just a hypothesis. But down here on the bottom end, we got this curve proven. Those are working experiments. So if we can get something that ties us up to show consistency, not only consistency, but proof, experimental evidence up at the top, then we got a good model. So that work remains to be done yet. In fact, it's beyond my capability. I'm just saying, hey, guys, take a look at this. Next slide, please. Well, for anti-gravity, I'm the co-author. I wrote the paper, but since I was not the inventor, I put the inventor's name first, as was proper scientific protocol. I worked with an inventor named Floyd Sweet, who did have a device. It was a free energy device. It produced 500 watts, had 1,500,000 gain. The ones that I worked with, you still put an input in, very low. And this is the early device that didn't produce the 500, but it produced 6 watts, but it produced it right out of the thin vacuum. This is the first device he had. I didn't bring the picture of the 500-watt device. I'm sorry. I went off without it. But here's his four little 1.5-watt light bulbs being lit on vacuum energy. So he eventually built another one, and I gave him a paper on how phase conjugation was working in this device. That got tied up later in litigation, so I've never released that paper, and I don't intend to it until release it till the day I die, because I don't want to get sued again. Had enough of that nonsense. But anyway, it is a real process. The machine was real, and it produced real energy. Now, let's go to, I think I got another slide there. Let's see. I had a problem. I had a theory of anti-gravity. And if I was right, since he was producing a mixture of energy and phase conjugate energy, time-reversed energy, this machine could be used to produce anti-gravity, if I were right. If the machine would not produce anti-gravity, I had to go back to square one on the drawing board. So I had what you call one of those very critical points in everything I was doing. The whole shebang, talk about your risk, the whole shebang rode on one experiment. So I convinced Sparky to do this experiment. And he rigged the machine this way. And what happened is, on this slide, wouldn't it be nice if you knew how to do anti-gravity? Well, let's have a little session. What is gravity? Well, it's really a curvature of space-time, but more than that, what's curving the space-time is negative energy, so we're talking time-reverse type of energy. You're bringing in energy, which then interacts with the mass. In general relativity, it isn't mass that produces the gravitational stuff. It's the energy inside the mass, and that's negative energy for gravitation. So you're producing time-reversed energy inside this mass. That means on the positive charges down in the nucleus. So you got the heaviest part. The electrons don't matter too much. And so what we, as a function of this negative energy which interacts with this mass continually, it's in a negative energy flow. The electrons actually strip off the positive energy flow, positive time flow, and the protons strip off the negative time flow, or the negative energy flow. And so down in the nuclei and all, I have the negative energy to create the gravitation. Now, let's reason together. If that's the process, in very simplified form, suppose I were to bring in a lot more phase conjugate energy, but not let it interact with a mass. Instead, cause it by nonlinear wave interaction to suddenly move out away from the mass. I would bring in the energy. This is gravitational. It's negative energy. This is gravity. And expel it. Well, if holding negative energy generates gravity, expelling the negative energy instead of holding it should generate anti-gravity. That's about as simple as I can make it, without getting real boring. But that's basically the simple-minded statement of the theory as to how it would work. Well, this machine was doing that in the nucleus already. So fortunately, it was a matter, once it's rigged to do that in the nucleus, the only thing left to do is just draw more energy in the load, because it was diverting excess energy coming in and diverting it to the load and not going into the atomic nuclei. In a nutshell, that's it. So he put 10 light bulbs, 100-watt bulbs on it, put it on a nice little scale on the lab bench, put in one light bulb and did a reading with all his instruments. He had some fairly nice instruments. Put in another light bulb and lit it up and did the measurements. And the machine got lighter. Now, I had predicted in advance that this machine would levitate at about 1,400 to 1,500 watts power output. We didn't dare go to that, because when you deposit excess energy in a set of permanent magnets, you're depositing monopoles when you're doing this, and the things will explode like hand grenades at some points. And he did blow up a few magnets, and I didn't want him to get killed like a hand grenade in his little apartment. So I said, don't go above 1,000 watts no matter what you do. And very excitedly, I was in Huntsville when he did this experiment. He's on the phone with me. He's reading these numbers off to me, and I'm writing down the numbers as he did the experiment. And that is the numbers, and that is the curve that plotted from that experiment. Smoothly and controllably, loss of weight of the machine sitting right there in the laboratory. Nothing's jiggling, nothing's wiggling, nothing's rotating, no moving parts. Now, I never saw this one, but Sparky told me later that his curiosity got the better of him. And then after he hung up the phone, he flew the damn thing. I cannot say that is true. I personally did not see that. This experiment is real. Now, I don't know about his flying experiment. Unfortunately, Sparky Sweet is dead, as everybody knows. I will tell you another curious effect. Sparky was a protege and a personal friend, and the guy that was his great mentor was Gabriel Krohn. And the experiment that did not happen was probably done by that group. And I won't say any more. Next slide, please. I think that thing was connected back there some way to Gabriel Krohn's negative resistor. Can't prove that. And I think it was connected to a certain mysterious experiment on the East Coast in 1943 that, of course, we know didn't happen. Okay. The greatest energy collection and usage thing in the world is a quantum potential. Bohm's hidden variable theory of quantum mechanics has been in the literature since 1952 in Physical Review, our leading journal. Our guys are still thinking about whether they like it or not, whether it appeals to them. Russians jumped on it like mad. So did another group or two. But I want to discuss with you how to make one of these things. I have here two things that are phase conjugate reflectors, this one and this one over on the right. First beam that goes across, this one reflects one back. The next reflection, they narrow the beams. The iterative reflection keeps on going, and eventually, if I run this thing long enough and I got good enough longitudinal waves going there, this thing will snap. And there will be a laser-like set of phase conjugate beams with nothing but negative time in the middle, connecting those two things. When that happens, I just inverted space-time, and it turns out it cancels the distance over there in the normal space-time. I have now entered a magic mathematical regime called multiply connected space-time. Wheeler calls it wormholes. This point right here in that space-time is absolutely superposed directly over that point, and you can move that other gadget now anywhere you wish to over past the star Sirius, and there's still an instantaneous zero-length connection between the two. It's better than that. If I put 1 kilojoule of energy in here, 1 kilojoule appears instantly in here with no propagation through space, our space, in between. It's in a multiply connected space. You know, in mathematics, they told you this curious little thing. You take a flat piece of paper, you put a point on it, put another point on top of that, put another one on top of that, another one on top of that, put an infinite number on top of that, as many as you wish, right? Put 1 joule in one point. What about all those other points? Every one of them got 1 joule in it. Think about it. This is what happens here. Now, once you do that, you have a quantum potential. My laser's going here, but now all these different objects here are connected by this thing, and it's as if they're one object at one location, one point. Whatever's in one is in all. It's the greatest energy amplifier known to man because there's an unlimited number of points which can be so linked if you build the linkage as you go and connect all those with a quantum potential. If I put in 1 joule of energy and I have 10 million points so linked, I will have 10 million joules output. Exactly. Exactly. Now, I hate to tell you, and I wish I didn't have to say it, but that thing has been weaponized. And the greatest weapons on the face of the planet today do not exist in the U.S. arsenal, and they are that type of weapons, and I'm not here to discuss them. But they do exist. What I'm here to tell you is how they affect living systems. Next slide, please. But that is the greatest energy amplifier known. I suggested this once as a communication medium. I couldn't get anybody's interest. I mean, what the hell, you want to communicate with your submarines? Why bother about ELF? Do one of these things and you're there the moment you send it and nobody else will ever detect it because it never propagated through space. If you want to put a robot on Mars and rove it around, why wait for that extended length of time for the signals to get back? Put in an instantaneous connection with longitudinal waves and you have zero lag time and you can control it just like you're sitting here on a bench controlling it on Earth. You can do something in real time with robots on the surface of Mars. Nice robots, well-controlled, well-behaved robots. None of this jazz we went through. We're little kitty carts about me. So longitudinal waves are an idea whose time has come because you can do it all once you make the longitudinal waves and use them. But certainly communication would be very useful to all humankind. It would be have no distance effect whatsoever. The energy requirement is phenomenally small. You got the energy in every part, every receiver, as soon as you put it in a transmit. And by the way, there's no difference in transmission and receiving because there's no time delay. Next slide, please. Anyway, I hope I stirred somebody up there at DOD and gave them an idea. I don't know. Okay, we're going to talk about, real brief, these new electromagnetic waves. Next slide, please. We're going to go a little fast here. Like the Cajuns say, about 5 o'clock in the morning, I looked out and my other friend Jean-Pierre is coming in there all drunk up in the head a little bit, and he's pulling one of them big log chains behind him. Great big thing. Just struggling and everything. 5 o'clock in the morning, I say, "Hey, Pierre, what in the hell are you doing pulling that log chain down the road?" And he'll stand and wipe his brow and says, "Man, do you ever try to push it?" Anyway, if I have a normal garden variety transverse wave right here in red, or excuse me, in blue, if I put a phase conjugate replica on that, and that is what phase conjugation does, and add another one to it, they will superpose in space everywhere, and they do something magic. If you look at the impulse and not the force in the force fields, that thing kills all the transverse oscillations. The energy density now oscillates along the line of motion of propagation of the wave. It is a longitudinal wave. So can I make one? Yeah, phase conjugate people do it every day and hadn't recognized it until recently. So that makes a longitudinal EM wave, which means as it's traveling along, it's surging back and forth, to and fro, along its line of travel as it goes. That's the way it oscillates. The energy density is surging back and forth. It's like a reverberation energy, if I might use that term. Now, if I take that wave and I move him down here and I phase conjugate once again, I now have a different breed of critter altogether because I freeze that other dimension. The energy can now not vibrate along the propagation path either. The energy can't oscillate. The only degree of freedom left over, at least as long as we stay in enforced space, is the time domain, the time dimension. And this cat actually oscillates in the time dimension. But it's very small because the time dimension is energy compacted by the figure C squared, just as mass is. So you've got to pour a lot of energy in here to get just a little tiny time oscillation. But it's quite possible to oscillate the rate of flow of time and to fill it full of all kinds of oscillations and patterns and influence. And it's highly compressed energy that you're using. Just you might as well be using mass around. It's a special form of nuclear energy, if you will, without all the radioactive byproducts. Next slide, please. What happens is, because matter adds these phase conjugates, once I start getting pretty good phase conjugates, so I have longitudinal waves made, and I start bombarding mass with those quite a bit, what I will do, the mass will add some phase conjugates and I will charge up in the time domain as opposed to the energy density domain. A new form of excited state that does not presently appear in physics. And the time domain charge is one heck of a lot more energetic than the energy charge because it's the energy condensed or compacted by the figure C squared. So to get a little time charge, you pour in lots of energy. You usually wait a while till it gets started so you get enough to detect. But it's a totally new interaction, very easily done in the nucleus, and there is nothing in all the nuclear engineering or nuclear physics literature that will tell you what this does. Now we're going to tell you a little bit of what it does. Next slide, please. One of the things we really wish to do is make those time reversal zones, get lots of that phase conjugation going. So when the normal waves going back and forth are less than the amount of time phase conjugate waves going back and forth, that is by definition a time reversal zone. And time in that zone starts moving backwards a little bit for whatever critter is in there. It doesn't move for the whole world, just for that little zone and the critters in there. Doesn't matter what that critter is. The interesting thing is it also has a selection criterion. Pauli exclusion principle won't let you time reverse a single fermion. That's a proton, that's an electron, that's a neutron. But it will permit you to do it if you have two of them, or four of them, or six of them, or eight of them. If you have even numbers, they will time reverse. But odd numbers won't. So you cannot time reverse a single electron, but you can time reverse two. You cannot time reverse a single proton, but you can time reverse two. Or you can time reverse a proton and a neutron. Two fermions. Okay, next slide, please. Does that have some use? Yes, in the first place, I'm going to talk about an extension to the conservation of energy law, because otherwise you're never going to understand cold fusion. Right now, they wrote a special case. The Einstein case is a special case. We're adding a third term. First, we had just the conservation of energy in energy form, and mass was conserved in mass form. And then they found you could transmute the two between each other. Uh-oh. That means you had to put the two together. So what we did, we put together the first equation. We conserved mass energy, and then we conserved energy in energy form, like waves and so forth. And it was the combination of the total of the two. Added up all the energy, like the potential energy, the chemical energy, the this energy, the that energy, and then we added up the mass energy, and that's what was conserved, all the energy. Now we got time density energy. We got a new form of energy in the time domain. So now we must add another term. We've got to have energy that's in any kind of energy form, E sub T, the total of all of that, ET is the total energy, is equal to the energy in energy form, EE, plus the energy that's locked up in mass, is mass form, mass energy, plus the energy that's locked up in time. 1 second of time is equal to 9 × 10^16 joules of energy. You can say the same statement for mass. Only 1 kilogram. So now, we have to rewrite this with the time term added, because if I start to transduce some of that time energy in that first equation, E sub T, back over into E sub M, I lift some mass out of it, like out of the Dirac C or so forth, or E sub E, I produce some scattered heat energy, extra. If you use the conventional conservation of energy rules without the extra term, you will see a violation of your expression of the conservation of energy law. Sorry about that. Conservation of energy law is still alive and well. It's kicking. It is not being broken. But your little version of it is being broken, because the version we've been using up to now is only 2/3 of it. We now added the missing third. Do I have any basis for that? Of course. Let me tell you something magic, and for some reason, very little known. In physics, the choice of fundamental units is totally arbitrary. What this Cajun said? What the hell did that mean? Well, you know, we talk about all them mass kilograms, and we talk about all them joules of electrical energy, and we talk about this unit and that unit, and we got all kinds of units that go on, and we don't have to have none of them. We can make everything out of one unit. And powers and functions of one unit. We can make it out of time if we want to. We can make it out of mass if we want to. We can make it out of length if we want to. It's all been done. Now, it's a lot easier to understand when you've got it laid out the way we do. We do it the way we do for ease of understanding. By the way, physicists change this all the time. When they have an easier way to express it mathematically by changing it, they just change it. This is no big deal in physics. Engineering thinks you've gone crazy. But it's true. But if that is true, then mass can be made nothing but time or nothing but energy. Time can be made nothing but energy, or energy can be made nothing but time. You see, these things are floating. They are not fixed and absolute and nailed in the wall. And somehow our guys don't get that. They don't understand that. But it's true nonetheless. So when I say time is energy, I'm absolutely right on. There's nothing wrong with that statement. The only question is, did I get the right function? That's the only question. The point that I'm going down to is, damn the function. You go do all the careful experiments and tell me if that's C squared or C cubed. I had one heck of a wrestle with my brain trying to make up my difference between C squared and C cubed, and I finally convinced myself it was C squared, but I won't argue with you if you come out C cubed. It's a big number any way you go. That's good enough for government work right now. But anyway, if any case that you have where a little time energy is transduced back into a different form, you know, energy can change its form, you will apparently see a violation of the conventional conservation of energy law. That's the bottom line. Next slide. And we're seeing that every day in experiments. Hundreds of scientists are seeing it. The future is to burn time as fuel. Now, how many times you heard that statement from the platform? Honest to God, this is true. If you burn 1 microsecond per second, you'll age a little slower, so you stay younger a little bit longer, live a little bit longer. And at the same time, by burning 1 microsecond per second, you will produce something like 9 × 10^10 joules per second of energy. Right out of thin air, right out of time. And if you can catch all of that, that's 9 × 10^10 watts. If you can catch 1/100th of that, it's still 9 × 10^8 watts. 900 million watts. That's a pretty good home powered unit. Maybe a city, big city. Anyway, this is the future. Hey, Pierre, we had a Department of Energy worth a damn, boy, it'd be working in debt right now, plumb. Because they're the one that say you can do all this stuff about take whichever fundamental constant or fundamental unit you wish. Take that thing as time and burn some time, and boy, have you got energy. And we are burning time in cold fusion, and I'll show you that or discuss it. Next slide, please. First, I'm going to detour to healing. I don't know what time I'm running here. Somebody give me a highlight, because I've got a good bit of material yet. Okay, I want to go through this quickly. With the longitudinal waves, a magic thing occurred, which is scientifically proven. It's in the scientific literature. They never could find out what the mechanism was. After 14 years of hard struggle, I found out what the mechanism was, and it's real simple. But I want to show you what Priori did. Next slide, please. 60s and early 70s, this man cured all kinds of stuff. Terminal tumors in lab animals, arteriosclerosis, infectious diseases, and it was real simple. You take 30 rats, you graft them all with a terminal tumor, guaranteed every rat going to be dead in 30 days, no question. Certified, bona fide by the ordinary biological community. You separate them into two groups, 15 that get the treatment, 15 that don't. The ones that get the radiation all live, get rid of the tumor, restore their immune system. The 15 that don't get the treatment all die. You do it over and over and over again. And then you do it with rabbits. Same thing. Okay. This is a shot of his small machine. This is about the second one he built. That's a big plasma tube up at the top, and there's a big coil wrapped around it. And there's a little box down on the bottom, where a little cage where he puts the rats. And what you do In this plasma tube, you mix a mix of frequencies. They're in the radar band and microwave bands. The plasmas we know today add a phase conjugate, some phase conjugation. So you get some longitudinal wave formation. We know from Whitaker 1904 that we can take all those fields and all inside this tube, this plasma tube, and inside this coil with DC magnetic pulsing that. And we can replace all of that mess with two scalar potential functions. 1904 paper, proof of it's in the literature. It started a thing called superpotential theory, so that's well known. I don't have to prove that, you see. I just got to refer folks to the literature where that's long since been proven for many, many years. Yes, he should be on the web. And by the way, lots of other good scientists worked in that area. Dubai, McCrae, a whole bunch of them, I think. Dirac did some work in it. And they named potentials after all of these guys. So every time you see a named potential, he worked in superpotential theory and found a new one. Okay, Richard says that on his website, the two Whitaker papers are there. They are very fundamental. Please read them in the physics section. They are very fundamental papers. Please read them. The 1903 paper has still been ignored to this day. Okay, what we do is, once we view it that way, it means that all of those potentials superpose. That's what potentials do. Scalar potentials superpose. So coming out of that is all that stuff put together into one entity. It turns out to be a pulse DC magnetic field with an interior of the field itself, 1903 paper, and four combined, that's filled with longitudinal wave pairs, pump waves, time density waves. That's what a longitudinal wave pair is. And so we're pumping the rat with time density waves. We're pumping that rat in the time domain, not the spatial energy domain. We ain't going to make no time reverse waves. They're made in the time energy domain, space energy domain. We're not even in that domain. We're in the time energy domain. What you do there is whatever energy is there, in whatever form it's in, you reverse it in time. Well, the energy is there in the form of mass. Yeah, Pierre, don't care what that is and what form that is. You're going to take all that dude and reverse it, fields and all, and everything with it right back to the previous state. This critter will time reverse living mass, living cells, and every and each individual part of them back to a previous state. Let's reason together. What's the problem in AIDS? When you get an HIV infection, there is, we know now, it's not dormant at all. What happens is the entire immune system rouses mightily and gets 99% or so of it. It does an enormous effort. But 1% of it gets by. It's a little bitty, tiny, different strain. And the immune system didn't recognize it and didn't attack it. But it got 99% of those infected cells. It said, you're hostile, you're foreign, you don't belong. Boom. But then the others reproduce and they're more resistant. So the immune system comes back and this time only gets, let's say, 75% of them. This process continues and pretty soon the poor old immune system is losing its own cells. It's a finite system. It no longer can do the job and the ravages of the AIDS infection appears. And mostly the inevitable end is death. Doesn't have to be. Simply pump every cell, the magnetic field, the DC field, carries it through every cell, including the bone marrow cells where all the immune cells are born. There's nothing in the body that gets left out, not to the tiniest part of any cell. And every one of those gets time reversed back to a previous state, genetics and all. You kill the main problem. You get rid of that residue that was sitting there and going to stay there and come back to reinfect you more. They're gone. There is no more HIV virus left in that body in any cell. This is what the medical community ought to be restoring. This is in the hard French literature. Eminent scientists work with it. It's real. They just didn't know the mechanism because phase conjugate optics hadn't been born in the 1960s. Nobody knew that. Much less that you could time reverse mass. Next slide, please. Here's one of his other machines are a little bit bigger. This is, I think, the one that he treated rabbits in. Next slide, please. They're all built the same way. Turn that around. That's on the side. The other way, get that patient laying down. Otherwise, he's going to fall on his head like the... Okay, what we have here is we have his giant. This is the last one he had. There's a 12-something-foot-long tube up there, plasma tube, and a big field of radiation. This is made to radiate an entire human body. He had permission, and his intention was to move all these animal experiments into terminal patients with their consent, which, you know, is legal, and proper scientific auspices and control. And shortly after that, when he started curing all these people of cancer and leukemia and everything else, very shortly this would have entered the medical establishment. The French government fell. Chancellor left this government. He lost his powerful benefactors that was keeping him funded, and they pulled all the funding and they suppressed that like it had never been, and rejected his doctorate, which was out at the University of Bordeaux. I have that doctoral thesis in my possession, the actual document he submitted. Next slide, please. No, I'm not. I wanted to do that. It's a good question. I ran into a strange situation. The Priory heirs and the French government, and Priory died in 82, I believe it was, and the French government and Priory heirs and a couple of companies that put money in it are still in a great legal battle. And I had French help working real hard to try to get me permission. French laws, by the way, are very funny on copyright. They're not like ours. And the bottom line is, if I were to do that, I had a friend, Alan Beaulieu, who very kindly, in his own effort in Canada, did a good technical translation into English. I was going to publish that full thesis in English and French free. I don't want any money out of it. I want Priori's name to be remembered. I want the results of the work to be known. I'm writing a book where I'm giving all the mechanisms and everything, and that will be published on the internet. But I was told that if I didn't want to be sued to the bottom of my socks, I can't do that unless I wanted to be sued. So I won't be doing that. I'm sorry. I wish I could. If I can get permission from the Priori heirs, it will be published. But I'm not going to be able to get permission. This is that 12.5-foot tube. You can see that giant tube if you look careful. This was a multi-million-dollar process even back in those days. It's estimated he spent somewhere between $3 and $6 million, and the going rate now, multiply that by somewhere between 10 and 15. That's the size of the project we're talking about, $40 to $60 million today. This is not a simple little thing. Rather large number of scientists, including some very eminent ones like Robert Courier, head of the biology section of the French Academy, worked with him and personally presented the results to the assembled Academy. Raymond Potrozel, one of the leading parasitologists of the entire world, worked with him. Enormous work Potrozel did. Next slide, please. It's all in the French literature. It's all documented. This really happened, and nobody could understand how it worked. These are the things that they cured: terminal tumors, clogged arteries, arteriosclerosis. We got millions of people afflicted with that alone. It cleaned them out just slick as a whistle. Suppressed immune system. They took rats and deliberately suppressed immune, restored it right back, no problem. Infectious trypanosomiasis. It really did a number on that. And a horrible infection in rabbits that were cured. It was just impossible by anything else. The rabbits should have been dead. The results presented to the French Academy by Robert Courier, and nobody in the whole cotton-picking world understood how it worked. And the regular medical community rose up in arms. As long as his buddies from fighting with the old French underground during World War II were still alive and in control of the government, he was funded. The moment that government fell and they got turned out, he got canceled and the entire program suppressed. And he died, and that was the end of that. Next slide, please. I was involved in an effort to try to restore that while he was still alive. Spearheaded by a multimillionaire out of Nashville, whose brother was dying of leukemia, had everything, including bone marrow transplant, nothing worked. Found out I knew of a machine which, under scientific auspices, I'm not talking about a backyard version in the garage, I'm talking about under scientific auspices with real good scientists and real good laboratories, had actually cured cancer in lab animals, essentially 100%. Make a long story short, Bob went to France, hired a team of French detectives, found Priori, walked in, knocked on the door, set up a conversation with him. They hit it off like old buddies. Started flying back and forth across the Atlantic. Very soon we had agreements with the French government and with the Priori group. We were going to rebuild the machine. We had $16 million of funding from some wealthy doctors. These were pledges, written pledges. We were going to fund the work in Bordeaux. The machines would be built and tested individually in Bordeaux, and once proven, would be then sold to large medical establishments, research establishments, throughout the world, and for use in treatment of terminal patients with their consent and cure cancer. Now, a very short time, we'd have had this thing in the medical community. You understand what I'm saying? Priori was still alive. There's no question about somebody knew how to build it. Well, at that point, the last meeting with Bob, Priori laid his arm around his shoulder and said, sadly, he said, "Bob, if you rebuild my machine, I guarantee you I will save your brother's life. I swear to you, I will save his life." Of course, he never got the chance. Some folks who remain unknown and mysterious called all the doctors and said, "If you put 1 cent into this project, every living member of your family, man, woman, and child, will be destroyed. Now, if you want proof, tell me which child you wish to lose." Oh, that C word, isn't it? Not all science is played by the rules. People that make lots of money off of dead people don't want to give up their powerful positions and a lot of money. There are some people who don't give a damn how many millions of people die every year as long as they make money on it. And a dead cancer patient is $300,000 lying on a slab. And ladies and gentlemen, that doesn't have to be. And that's got to change. And that machine will cure it. The only thing happened that made me awfully mad, and I said, if I live long enough and stay in this body long enough, I will break the secret of how that machine works. And 14 years later, I have broken it. And you have it now. And it's going to go on the internet. Next slide, please, because I want to tell you what's on this chart, but I want to tell you what pictures. People talk about smoking. I want to tell you a little something about smoking they don't tell you. They found a very strange thing. They've only known this just a few years. The hemoglobin, you see, chemically cannot carry the amount of oxygen that it has to actually take on and carry in the body of itself. It cannot do that chemically. However, there's an ancillary process that's used to allow it to do that. About 40 to 60 water molecules get right around the red corpuscle and engage in hydrogen bonding actions with the hemoglobin, changing its chemistry so that the hemoglobin can take on a lot more oxygen than it could otherwise carry. And so it's not just the red blood cell that carries the oxygen to your cells. It's the red blood cell plus the action of 40 to 60 water molecules. And all you people wondered what water played in your body, didn't you? It gives you the very air and the oxygen that your cells need to live. They found another thing. If you put any kind of contamination in that water, those 40 to 60 water cells put something else in there with them around it, kaput. You spoil the action. And the ability to take on oxygen goes way down, to the desperate level, to the hypoxic level. So when you smoke a cigarette and you inhale the tars and nicotines right into the very places where your hemoglobin is trying to take on this excess oxygen with all these water molecules helping it, and bingo, in go the tars, co-whap. You reduce suddenly, dramatically, the ability of those red corpuscles to take on oxygen at all. Your entire body is in a dire emergency condition for survival at that moment. And your deep control system kicks in with every trick it's got known to us. It cuts down anything in the body that uses oxygen. It stops and lowers the metabolism dramatically. Slows the heartbeat, all kinds. This relaxation you get, that's a great emergency in your body, with the body exerting its utmost interaction to survive. You're damn near dead, and you think it feels good. And they tell you, oh, smoke this cigarette, boy, and enjoy this nice relaxation while it's killing you. Well, there's an aftermath to that. There is a system studied by Robert Becker, which I've added to because he didn't have the right electromagnetics, but he certainly did study the right system, the regenerative system in the body, which is what heals everything. And it uses the kind of electromagnetics we've been talking about. And so I've added to it to complete Becker's work, I hope, if it holds up. And we now, for the first time, will have, finally, building on his work, the answer to how the regenerative system in the body really works. Becker should have had a Nobel Prize for his magnificent work, but he didn't get one, but he should have had one. He was nominated twice. Anyway, this control system in the body orders all of these things that it has in its fingertips. Next slide, please. But you continue, and you think that smoking relaxes you, and it does, to prevent your death from hypoxia, but you have a sustained hypoxic condition in the body, and that's bad. If you breathe this in with the smog that you live in Los Angeles, you have a sustained hypoxia condition in your body. If you breathe in the battle smoke in the Gulf War, you have a sustained hypoxic condition in your body. And it goes on and on. You can carry it on from there. If you get a lot of pesticides and stuff in your air, contaminants in your air, where you live and breathe, you have a sustained hypoxic condition in your body. Ladies and gentlemen, in almost every human disease, hypoxia is involved. And it is heavily involved in cancer. And here's why. We are told the cells on Earth, and there's good evidence for this, started off by being single anaerobic. That means non-oxygen using. There wasn't much oxygen in the atmosphere. It wasn't underused much. So they had to be anaerobic. Well, as they multiplied and were successful, one of their byproducts was oxygen, and so they contaminated their atmosphere with oxygen. This is a cesspool we're living in. Welcome to the cesspool, fellow critters. We love this oxygen. We need it for our lives. But it used to be the contamination for these guys. Anyway, they developed first several branches along the line I hadn't shown. There was one cell, and still a few of them around, and tried to be able to be a switch hitter and go either way. It wasn't too efficient at either one, so it never was all that successful. But they still exist, that are both anaerobic, partially, and partially aerobic. Anyway, we finally had enough oxygen so that the aerobic cells emerged. Now, they have always a small anaerobic residue. If you have to have sudden emergency energy, you ain't got time to get all your breathing going and all this worked up and get warmed up. You got to run. The flea thing for survival. And so you have a small anaerobic system that can give you a burst of energy quick. But when you run 100-yard dash, you use that up. You're fatigued at that point. Not from your aerobic system, but your anaerobic system has just been consumed. Anyway, we then arose out of the multicell, and that means there's a central system controlling all the cells and making them stay together and not outgrow one another and just grow off in any direction and coordinating everything. Got a big chief cook and bottle washer, and it's an electrical control system that operates in the body. That's that regenerative system as part of it. Anyway, that's the time forward part path as cells reversed or developed. When your cellular control system has used every trick that it has in the book, trying to get oxygen to the cells of your body, and you continue to live in an hypoxic environment, and it continues not to be able to do the job, it has another trick in its kit bag. because it uses this electromagnetic pumping and time reversal of mass that I've talked about. That's the way it changes cells from one thing back and forth into another. It can time forward them or time backward. In biology, time forwarding is called differentiation. Time reversal is called de-differentiation. This is what does it. It's a mechanism that actually does it to the cell. If you continue that, the system finally says, well, I done run out of everything I got, so to speak, like the Cajuns say, nothing left. But I can't get you enough oxygen, but my job is to keep you alive. So I'm going to change you form into a form that don't need oxygen. So you can stay alive. You're still my kit bag and you're still my responsibility. I'm going to keep you alive. Because it does that. And it takes that cell in your lungs that's so hard hit by that smoking, and it orders that cell, but not with a signal, with a vacuum engine. It goes in and grabs that cell and works on it and changes it back towards an anaerobic cell, back to its primitive ancestors. It starts back that. The first break is with the central control. Breaks it back to where it's an independent cell growing on its own. And we call that a cancer cell. It's also usually partially anaerobic at this point. And that is what is the about 90% cause of cancer. Not what they tell you in the book. There's two things required for cancer. That's damage to a cell, sustained damage, and promotion. And they ain't got the foggiest notion what generates promotion into cancer. That's what it is right there. It's ordered and done by the central control system of the body, and that's why it won't kill the cancer cell, most of them, because it still recognizes that cell as self. It protects it, shields it from its own immune system to a large degree, provides it with food, supplies its needs, and keeps it alive and growing. That's its job. It's functioning just like it's supposed to do. And cancer is not a sign that you've just developed some invasive sickness. It's a sign that your body has had to take emergency measures because it can no longer furnish the oxygen to your cells, and it had to take an emergency action to change that cell into cells that didn't need so much oxygen. That's cancer, leukemia, and so forth. Next slide, please. The priori system will time reverse all of that and back it right back up into aerobic cells. You erase the slate and start with a clean backboard. That's what it does. You'll still develop the same thing, do it again. In most cases, you won't live long enough to redevelop the cancer. But it will clean it out that way. You'll just simply back it back up to that normal central control situation again. Okay, this is just a diagram that shows you can time reverse cells or mass. Now, if you time reverse aluminum, that ain't very interesting. You just got aluminum when you finish. But it can get interesting. Next slide, please. Suppose I don't want that cell to go back, or that piece of metal to go back to a previous state. Greedy devil that I am. I would like for that aluminum or whatever he is to turn into gold. That's what I need. That's what's spendable at the bank, not that aluminum. Can you do that? You bet your bottom dollar you can do that. Pumping it will move it back along a single path from where it came. That's not very interesting for inert matter. Very interesting for living matter. That's the way we want to go. But for inert matter, I would like to deviate from the trajectory to back through the past. All I got to do is furnish another vacuum engine and add to the pumping. I can steer that thing to anything I wish to, anything I'm smart enough to calculate and figure out what to put in there as an excess vacuum engine. I can steer that thing into anything I wish to. I can assemble the elements of whatever I want to. In theory, you can make anything out of anything. The easiest thing is to start in a fluid and just start assembling the hydrogens and convert some of them into neutrons, because all you got to do is flip one quark there and assemble whatever element you need to assemble. Okay, but this way allows you to engineer mass any way you wish to when it's developed. Now, this right now is a sketch. It's an idea. It's a principle. And if I ever finish the darn thing, get it filed, it's also information, invention disclosure to be followed by a patent application. Because with this, you can engineer matter, and you don't need high-energy physics. You're doing it low energy. Next slide, please. Here's Becker's work. Becker put a DC potential across these horrible bone fractures. This is one part of his work. But he did something better than that. Not only did he notice that the bone healed, but he went in to find out what was happening. It turned out that the red corpuscles came into that area and shucked their hemoglobin and grew a cell. They changed into a more primitive form. Then they changed forward into the kind of cell that makes cartilage, and that's not what was needed. They changed again into the kind of cell that makes bone, and that was deposited and healed the bone. He showed that the cells just changed both backwards and forwards in time, only they call it dedifferentiation and differentiation in biology. But it's really moving it back in time and moving it forward in time. A previous state and a future state. It's all controllable by simple means. This is millivolt and picoamperes of current. But we know that that DC potential from Whitaker 1904 is made of longitudinal wave pairs. Each wave plus its phase conjugate. We know that's a time density wave now because you're educated now. And we know that he was pumping it in a time domain, which is exactly what he had to do to heal it. Next slide, please. Yes. You can get a limited effect with that kind of approach. Now, it's limited because what's happening with that approach, too much of the electricity stays on the surface. You don't get it down to every part of the cell. And to really reverse the cancer correctly, you have to get down into the genetics, and you have to alter them back to their previous form. Well, the DC potential alone won't get deep into the genetics. But if you put it in a magnetic carrier, it will. But you've got to enfold it the way Priori did, you see, before you start. You can do a limited amount with that, and lots of people are, and they get some cures, and they get some that doesn't do any effect at all. The scientific community will claim that you're nothing but a fraud if you do this, and they'll put you in jail for doing that. The only way on God's green earth we ever got a chance of getting this done is to bring it in under the full auspices of the scientific community, see that all the tests are done, the proof is given, the results are shown with lab animals. So, yes, you can get some limited results. You can get limited results with a Lehovsky oscillator, and you get about half bad results and about half good results. So you make it worse as often as you do any better. So those kinds of methods that vary all over the map are just not dependable. You have to have something that has precision in it. The only way to get that is to first make the longitudinal waves, then use a guaranteed way to get those down to the very depth of all the matter. It has to go right down into the nucleus of the atom, and the magnetic field will do that. It'll get you there. That way you get it to quarks. You get it everything you've got to get at. And that will get you a really true time reversal of the disease state. So any way, it doesn't mean magnetics maybe necessarily is the only way, but any way that will guarantee that penetration to the finest level is acceptable. You can put the carriers, you can enfold the carriers by several ways. But the basic requirement is you must not leave any of it out. You must get all the genetics and everything. You can't just hit the surface of the cell. Next slide, please. Potential application should be obvious. Now, this last thing, this one, let's hold this one a minute. I want to show you something I've, a little bit with tongue in the cheek, but quite seriously, have proposed to DOD, and they don't even know what I'm talking about. I got about a snowball's chance in you know where of ever getting this started, but somebody has got to do this. The greatest strategic threat to this country right now, the official threat, is terrorist attack on our cities, including biological warfare strike. 100 kilograms of anthrax sprayed from a small plane, standard agricultural sprayer, on a calm night over Washington, D.C. will give you 1 to 3 million casualties, almost all of whom are going to die. With the spreading of the immune system and thinning of the immune system, which is presently ongoing by the KGB in this country with a quantum potential, and I'm not here to discuss that, I'm just telling you it's going on, multiply those figures by five. So instead of 1 to 3 million casualties, you will get 5 to 15 million casualties from that same 100 kilograms of anthrax spores, almost all of whom are going to die. Now, do you know why this is our greatest strategic threat? Right now, there's nothing out there that will save those people, and it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. The teams are here in country. The agents are here. The terrorists are here now with the stuff in their hands, on site, ready to go. This is not Tom Bearden. This is your official threat. It is going to happen. Those millions are going to die. But if we would restore a small portable version of the Peoria unit, we could save with a first generation unit possibly 70% of them. Next slide, please. This is what it would look like, something like this. Plasma tubes, we can make them thumbnail size this time. We have to work out the inner constructions. Everything affects it. We got to be sure we get the longitudinal waves. That's all a development problem. Once we have that, and we can have it computer controlled, we can select for whatever the strike is, we can select the type of pump waves that we've already worked out in our research you've got to have. With a few settings of the dial and turn the damn thing on, that's all there is to treat. The patient will lie between two sheets where the coils and everything are making the magnetic fields on the sheets over and under his body. And all you're doing is radiating him with a magnetic field, pulse DC magnetic field that has the right stuff inside it. And you're time reversing those diseased and damaged cells. Anthrax particularly doesn't develop any symptoms until all of a sudden the guy's falling over dead. By the time you know he's sick, he's almost dead. It's too late to do much about it anyway. This way, if we know anybody is sick, we can be treating everybody. These things, once developed, this is a horrendous development effort, but once done, they will be cheap. They can be produced in mass. Thousands and thousands of these. We can flood the police departments, the fire departments, the hospitals, everybody with these things. Maybe we can save 70% of those people. Maybe we don't get the other 30. But by golly, 70% of 15 million people is one gosh-awful number of living Americans that otherwise going to die. That's what we got to do. This is the only thing on the horizon that can do that job. There are no vaccines for the civilian community. Even if we make some, it takes months and months and months to get any immunity established. When you get it established, if you change the strain, the vaccine is no good. Or if you get hit with enough of it, the vaccine won't work. All of this information is freely available on the Internet as far as what these biological agents will do to you. The Russians have been building them at some 17 continuing research institutes, varying all the things. Terrible smallpox strains that they've made, resistant to just about everything. All the terrorists have them. Some of those have to be in this country. We have this coming down. It's just a matter of when. And I'm trying real hard to make this message known and say, I don't give a damn. Who does this? It's got to be done. Or we're going to have a lot of dead Americans. Now, make your prediction. This will not be done until we have the first strikes and we got about 1 million or 2 million dead Americans lying out there in the streets. And we got a very angry American population that's saying, you guys were supposed to be looking after me. What happened? We've been paying you lots of money. You went to sleep on us. What happened? Then and then only will we get them in the mood to move. But we're going to keep their feet on the fire and keep them informed anyway. So, yes, we got a serious proposal on that. We want to see this done. Next slide, please. You can see what would happen if you ever had to use this and the medical community was confronted with it. And the fact that you can actually treat and cure diseases this way, look what that does to your normal medical practice. Reduces, terribly will reduce the cost of Medicare. Oh, my God. You cost a lot of people a lot of their power and influence and money. Serious opposition to that one. And this is opposed very seriously. That's a block diagram of it. Don't worry about that. We'll go on. Here's the chart that shows you we can put percentages on the chart, you know, a standard bar chart. I think with a second generation, a good scientific effort, you can get about 90% of them. I think the top you'll ever get is about 95%. As the strains come up and confront you with new strains, you go back down to about 70%. But then as you learn what strain it is and how to reset it, you come back up to 90, you see. It's still an unending battle, but, I mean, you're dealing on the high end rather than down on the low end where you're hurting. You can, after we learn enough about what strains are and how to do that kind of measure and that kind of count. In the future, we can do that. Right now, I don't know how. The first machine would need as fast as possible. So it'll be a simple machine. It won't be, you know, real complex. Second generation will be more sophisticated. Third, fourth generation begin to do what we're saying here. But by then, we'll know how to calculate vacuum engines. Right now, I don't know how to do that. Next slide. Excuse me. Your life expectancy is 24 hours if you make gold. I did that. Been there. Done that. And your life expectancy is 24 hours if you don't quit. I'm serious. I'm quite serious. There's several people in this country can make gold. And those people get watched all the time. They make the slightest move like they're going to make gold, they will join the used to be alive. Next slide, please. Let's get on here. Okay, I promised you I would get to the human species out of all this mess and show you that we do involve the human species. So let's look at mind and matter interaction very briefly. Next slide, please. The biological system is a very straightforward thing. Mind operations are time-like. They occur in the time domain. Every time they move, that's a little curvature in space-time, puts a little projection down across into space dimension, but it's in the virtual state. It's not observable yet. But when the mind intent keeps going coherently and keeps producing, they integrate to an observable change. That's a real change in the physical world coordinated precisely to your mental intent. Now, as the physical changes resulting from that occur, they make little curvatures in space, in three space, put a little projection back into the time domain. It's in the virtual state. So the mind don't see some of that yet. But as it continues to follow that path and that trajectory of doing that kind of change it's being directed to do, these continue to integrate until they reach a quantum level and make an observable change in the time domain. And that is the loop that joins the mind to the body. It comes across through the time domain. The curvatures in the time feeding over into space, the curvatures in space feeding back into time. Now, for that to remain coherent so that your mind stays attached to your body, and I use mind in the general sense, I'm including both conscious and unconscious, for that to stay nice and coherent and orderly and well done, the flow of time has to remain fairly orderly. If you break that coherence anyway, if you jerk or snatch the rate of flow of time, you pop the chain immediately, it's an instantly dead system. Every cell in it is dead instantly. Every virus, every protozoa. In the area that happens, any bird, any fowl, any germ, any beast, any man, whatever, is all dead instantly, totally. Just like a piece of meat that's been radiated with gamma radiation from cobalt-60. The Russians tested a weapon with that effect. I call it the mind snapper, in Afghanistan twice, killing a whole village each time. And yes, the bodies fell like dead lumps of meat. They are charged instantly with time charges. They continue to radiate slowly as the energy bleeds out of the time charge. Lots of it bleeds out for a period of time. As longitudinal waves, any living system coming in starts to get woozy, interfere with his mind-to-body linkage. If he stays in there, he's going to kill over and die. So he either leaves or dies. If a germ blows in and wants a bacterium and decides is a decay bacterium and would decay the flesh, he sickens and dies. And so the bodies lay there for over 30 days in the desert sun, did not decay whatsoever. No vermin ate them, no bacteria came in and blew in on the wind and ate them. I submit to you there's no gas in the world that can do that. They called it Smerch gas, wind of death. I spent 2 hours in Washington, D.C. with a representative from the Mujahideen to the United States government confirming that those two incidents happened. They, ladies and gentlemen, were for real. Anyway, if you break in normal death, what you do is you break the consistency of the body. The mind intent is still there, but the body is so disrupted it can't follow a coherent path. It doesn't get enough back to the mind world. It breaks the link, the mind separates from the body, and that is what we call normal death. Next slide, please. By the way, you're in a quantum potential. below the normal potentials of the body, they are all riding on a single quantum potential that joins the nuclei of every atom in your body. If you cut off your arm and set it off there in the corner, it's still linked to your body. The quantum potential for it is still there long after that decays. And yes, indeed, you do have a phantom limb, even though that limb is gone. And it's in the quantum potential, and it's in potential state. But it still feeds back in your mind system, and you still can feel the pain. And that is the phantom amputee syndrome that we get. And certain times and cases with Carillion photography, you can actually see, like a severed leaf they've done, to take it apart, and you can see where that leaf was. The pattern, the imprint, the quantum potential is still there. No, I haven't studied Carillion photography that deeply. Somebody who has might can do that, but I don't know how. It's just a state I don't know. Conscious and unconscious mind. Conscious mind is a serial processor. It's just like that computer sitting over in the corner. It does one operation at a time, but boy, is it a fast booger, like the Cajuns say. It does it so fast that you think you're doing all it at once, but really at any one point you only got one dot on the screen, so to speak. But it's so fast you got a whole screen full. You're recalling all the time so fast from memory. So that is our conscious mind, and it can only see one slide in the slide projector at a time, but it's very rapid. However, it is a serial processor. Now, the unconscious is totally inappropriately named because it's totally conscious. But it's not serially conscious, it's massively parallel. It's a massively parallel processor. It's got jillions of things going on at the same time. It's got one little piece that's taking care of that cell right there in my right knee. One is doing it right here. One is trying to communicate with this guy upstairs and can't figure out why he can't see all of this. I'm showing it to you. And this guy looks down and he sees 10,000 slides in the slide projector. He sees black, sees nothing. He said, "Hell, man, you're unconscious." And he said, "What do you mean unconscious? Look what I'm trying to tell you. Jillions of things. And you're too dumb to figure it out." Okay, we had to fit the conscious mind to the standard photon interaction, which the part that creates the real world that we normally observe is the serial photon interaction, one at a time. You get these other crazy things when you get multiple photon interactions, like phase conjugation, time reversal. But the normal garden variety, ordinary physical reality, is really created by the photon interaction, serial reaction. Your conscious mind is fitted to that, and so are Aristotle's three laws of logic. The fourth law is, in fact, fitted to multi-photon interaction. So what we have is a world that, to survive in against the animals, we couldn't really use our most massively parallel processor and look around at all this nice stuff in other dimensions and all, because the saber tooth was steady eating our leg off while we're doing that. That don't make no good sense. Like the Cajun said, you might be seeing some pretty pictures for a short time. So what's this virtual reality? It ain't all it's cut out to be. Just be sure you're not around where the saber tooths are when you're engaging in it. So we had to develop our conscious mind so that we could, in fact, survive in this level. The unconscious, however, is a massively parallel processor and has many capabilities that our conscious mind does not have. But the only way it can communicate is to shape all this stuff into a symbolic meaning. The word symbol means many meanings, for one thing. X means a whole bunch of things, whatever you apply it to. So it has to become a master playwright. It has to establish scenarios we call dreams. When we have repressed conflicts that we can't get rid of, it has to express that, so hopefully we'll know what it's talking about, what the trouble is. A trained analyst in either Freudian psychology or Jungian psychology, for example, can do a dream analysis if he knows enough about you, and he can tell you what these dreams mean. Okay, let's go down to the next level. Next slide, yeah. Well, unconsciousness, the massively parallel processors, which are embedded again in a quantum potential, don't stop because the levels of potential go deeper and deeper. At a weaker level, there is a quantum potential that fills the whole human species. There are even intermediate levels of little quasi-quantum potentials where your family and your city and the state and create these little variations, little lumps in the thing, so to speak. But eventually, there really is a quantum potential in every human being alive on Earth. And the mind operations at that level, which are unconscious, of course, because it's massively parallel, are what Jung called the collective human unconscious mind. It's very real. There's a physics of it. It's time-like operations, and it's at that level. And you can engineer it. And there's a very big race on right now to engineer that level. By the way, one of the problems with evolution is it's devilishly hard to explain how you could have gradual development from a snake-like critter or, you know, a reptile into a bird. Because while he was on the way to adapt into a bird, while his limbs were growing into wings and part limb, he can't run, he can't fly, everything in the world going to eat him up. He ain't going nowhere except to make a meal for somebody. The only way for a species to change from a reptile into a bird, which they did do, is for one day, out of nowhere, every egg that hatches out that a reptile has laid hatches into a bird. For the whole nine yards, like the Cajun says. Every reptile changes at once. That's done by the quantum potential, the collective unconscious. It accumulates all the results of all the deaths and everything else and the stresses of all its members above. It's like a racial memory, I think they called it. And what it does, it's a real thing, and it really does accumulate. And when it reaches enough stress, it really creates a new thing in the physical state. It actually goes up and changes. A vacuum engine creates, it kindles or integrates into observable form and changes the matter. And that's how a bird comes from a reptile. It comes in one leap, and now they talk about the jumps in evolution and wonder how they got there. This is the process that generates them. And by the way, it's an engineerable process. So, at a deeper level, we have a common quantum potential, even deeper, for all of the species on Earth. Yes, Gaia is quite real, and there it is, and it is engineerable. So the whole Earth is a living thing. By the way, everything that's ever been alive on Earth is still in there. The memory, this thing is alive, and its memories go back to everything that ever lived on Earth. Ain't none of it left out nowhere. So does the collective human species for every human that ever lived. Nothing is ever lost. Beyond that, you get whatever way you want to sort it out. Eventually, just gather all the life in all the universe, and that, of course, is the universal life, whatever you wish to call that. Call it God, whatever you wish. That's correct. If you have a cross species, certainly we know about cross species. We can cross an ass and a horse, and we get a mule, and sometimes we can actually get mules to reproduce. It's not quite true that they never reproduce. Mostly they don't, but occasionally they do. There's no reason at all, for example, speaking of humans and animals, the genetics of human beings and the highest primates are at least 98 to 99% the same, and that's closer than the ass and the horse is. So yes, indeed, humans can interbreed with high apes. That is true. Your biology teacher will tell you that if you press him in the corner and threaten to beat the life out of him if he doesn't tell you the truth. And then he will say, but nobody wants to say that. Well, it is true. I think that Oliver, for example, the chimpanzee that walked like a man and smoked cigars and everything, I think Oliver was in fact such a hybrid. Somebody did an experiment. But yes, that is true. And yes, if you ask me technically, is it possible for an interbreeding of a human-type species, be it from Mars or wherever, doesn't matter, with higher hominids or higher apes, the very highest apes on Earth, is that possible? The answer is yes. Technically, it is possible. It doesn't say it happened. It says it is technically possible. Nothing technically refutes it. Okay. Anyway, all mind in the whole universe is joined in part each of the other. Nothing is separate, and this is a living universe. It always has been, it always will be. And I am a religious person. I don't try to inflict my personal religion on anybody else. But to me, I'm glad I live in a living universe, because I'm convinced I'm not a meat computer. I'm convinced I do have to account for my actions with my fellow human being on this earth. And I'm going to try to give the best account I can. And for the failures, I'm just going to have to take the consequences. Next slide, please. Okay, what happens to an intelligent species? First of all, what the hell is intelligence? Everybody talking about human beings and intelligence, and nobody ever tells you what it is to be an intelligent species, or the two kinds of intelligent species. There's two kinds of intelligent species. One is a tool-using member. You can manipulate tools. You got some kind of manipulation. It could be a tentacle. It doesn't have to be fingers. We had to climb to get away from the saber tooth, so boy, did we have to be able to grab limbs. We lived in the trees, because if we came down on the ground, we got eaten up. We couldn't fight those dudes. So we had a good manipulative member. The dolphin, for example, is quite intelligent, probably as intelligent as we are, the bottlenose dolphin. Certainly we can't decipher his language. We're too stupid. According to John Lilly, who studied him for 8 years, and his dolphins finally committed suicide before they gave up on him. If you use the standard anthropology classification that intelligence is a function of brain weight to body weight, then the most intelligent animal on the face of the earth is the great blue whale. But it is not a technological intelligence, no manipulative manner, true member. So there's two kinds of intelligence. One is makes a superb adaptation to its environment and everything, but it doesn't have a tool-using member. The other one, however, has a tool-using member. Now, what do we mean by intelligence? We mean adaptability of behavior. Okay. What kind of control of them behavior do you got available? Well, you got two kinds. You got programmed control, computer and control technology come to our systems here, and you got that's available for learning or conditioning, software. So you got your hardware and you got your software. You can build programmed stuff into your hardware, wired into you genetically, or you can have a lot of available software, but you can't have both in a finite system. If you want to be more adaptable, you need more software. Well, you've got to tear out some hardware to make room for more software. So if you want to be real intelligent, you've got to tear out a lot of them hardware, provide a lot of them software. Oh boy, there's a good side and a bad side. I got some good news for you, I got some bad news for you. First, the good news. Boy, that makes you adaptable. If you're a tool-using animal, and you adapt for high intelligence, a lot of software, tear out a lot of your firmware and your hardware, a lot of your genetic control, your program control, you will become the most adaptable beast on earth. And because you adapt tools, your tool feet will become faster than any other animal's foot eventually. Your tool teeth will become sharper. You will eventually dominate the biosphere. That's the good news. Now I got some better news. Because you tear out the programmed checks and balances, many of them within your species, you do not have the limitations on your intra-species competition and conflict that most other lesser smart species have. For example, when male deer fight for territory, females, whatever, they have a fierce struggle, but it's stylized. Once in a great while is an accident, one kills the other, but it's an accident. They struggle very fiercely with all their vigor, and one of them finally weakens, can't make the grade anymore, and he turns to run. Well, the other one is perfectly capable of chasing him down and killing him, but he doesn't do it. And like the Cajuns say, it ain't got a damn thing to do with morality. He's got a switch which throws, programmed. So he stomps and snorts and paws the ground a little bit and fusses to show the females what a fine lad he really is and how lucky they really are to have him. as their Lord and Master, and how he's going to protect all this territory and all these great things he does, and he doesn't chase this guy down and kill him. But us smart critters, we tore out those checks and balances. When two men fight, for whatever reason, doesn't matter, one of them is perfectly capable, and quite often will, given the slightest sign of weakness of the other, kill him on a moment's notice. Also, we adapt our tools into our computation. We don't just kill one another with our hands or with stone axes anymore. We use nuclear bombs and rockets and God knows what else. So we become the greatest killers of our own species that has ever existed on the face of the earth. To be an intelligence tool-using species is to be a self-killer and to carry the seeds of destruction of your own species in your very intelligence and technology. Next slide, please. This is the problem. Like the Cajun says, we smart son of guns. We've been to Mars. We've been to the backside of the moon physically. We're flying rockets all around. We're sending probes all out. We got nuclear power. We got airplanes. We got this. We wipe out the animals. About to wipe out the biosphere. Man, we are some kind of dude. And we're killing the hell out of one another. We're poisoning the biosphere and we're strangling ourselves. We're fixing to strangle on our own waste. Cancer grows more rapidly every year. Hypoxia increases year by year. And it affects all other diseases. So we have a quandary. Let's have the next slide. This is a species problem. I ain't going to read all that mess to you. But the basic bottom line is this. We desire freedom and free will above all else. The quandary and the paradox we face is how can we retain free will and yet have control over man's inhumanity to his fellow man. Now, I use man in the general sense. I'm including the ladies, too. Sorry, the language is very awkward to try to include everybody. So the problem we have is, how do we keep our cake and eat it, too? Well, we have tried to impose this limitation on our self-killing by creed, by the ballot, by the bullet, by brute force, by psychological assistance, by conditioning, by drugs, by you name it. And none of it works. Now, each of it works for some of the people, some of the time, like Lincoln said, but none of it works for all of the people, all of the time. And even our religions turn out to be our greatest killers. More evil has been done in the guise of doing good for you by killing you over history than any other thing. We're going to save you by killing you. Maybe you ought not to save me. I'm doing pretty good like it is. So the problem is, what can we do? When we have a paradox like that, excuse me, I have to have a sip of this water if you don't mind. The first question is, what are the characteristics of a system which did accomplish what we wish we could do? What would be the characteristics? Well, the characteristics would be you would be absolutely have free will, except. Now, let's forget that and talk about the exception. And we want the absolute minimum exception that we can have. Does that sound reasonable to everybody? That's the best we could ever do, right? There's no better. Not unless everybody suddenly became perfect. Now, if we can find out how to do that, we're there already, but that's a tautology. If everything was perfect, it wouldn't be any imperfection, would there? If you find out how to do that, I'm willing to try that, but I haven't found out how to do that yet. But there is a way to do the limitation. What we want is no limitation at all until I start to abuse you. If I raise a hatchet to bury in your head, I want all the intent to leave instantly. I want to be able suddenly to see myself looking out of your eyes and feeling your emotions. I don't want to love my brother. I want to instantly be my brother and see it from his side and what it is I'm doing to him. Because at the quantum potential level and the unconscious level, I'm already doing that. I just don't know it consciously. The procedures are already there, but unfortunately that data is input only to the unconscious, the massively parallel processor. I want to lift it up and see it. I only want it to occur if I start to abuse you, or to kill you, or to hurt you, or to cheat you, or something like this. And then only, I want an absolute interruption like the male deer has. I want a switch to throw. And I don't want it to throw any other time. I put myself in a special kind of little gentle jail that says you have freedom in your range of operation except where your neighbor's nose begins. Isn't that the ideal we've really been trying to practice anyway? Well, we can do that. In theory, that's a doable. Next slide. Technology seeks to make everything smaller, more powerful, you know, ever cheaper. What is your projectile? What's the ultimate? Well, it gets so small you can hold it in two hands. It gets so powerful if you turn it loose and destroy the earth, blow it apart. It gets so cheap, it costs a couple $1,000s. Yes, it's simple. We got thousands of technologists that could build one. The parts are available anywhere. That's where technology is headed, ladies and gentlemen. I don't care what anybody tells you about how great technology has. That's the end of it. Because at that end, if we do not make this change in the human species, the species will destroy itself. You can show that mathematically, by the way. It's just servo mechanisms where the amplification factor is being turned up on each one, and there's no common control. That's a banging and clashing system that destroys itself, simple as pie. That's what we are on. That's the road we are on right now. Obviously, the answer is don't have the servo mechanism bang and clang together and beat one another to death. Stop each one right where it would do the clash and nowhere else. That's the answer to that servo mechanism problem. Next slide, please. So unless we want to go for technology's end, which is our destruction, we are a self-killing, self-destroying, self-disappearing species. And you thought all that stuff was biblical, didn't you? Guess what? We are the weapon of our own destruction. We carry it in our genes. And it's as inevitable as the day the first human set foot on Earth. It's just a matter of when, and we're getting very close. Okay, what kind of change? Next slide, please. Suppose we went down to the collective human unconscious and we instituted a little control mechanism, a very tiny little change, makes every human being, and it only responds when one human is starting to hurt another human deliberately. And it intervenes. Bang, just like that. Stops it. Throws a switch. That's all it ever does. Nothing else. Doesn't interfere with anything else. Well, it'd take a little adjustment for the robber to find out that he couldn't throw a gun on you and rob you if he suddenly forgot what he was going to do and turned around and walked off. It'd be very funny if the guy started to stab you and suddenly wondered why he was standing here. He was looking out of your eyes, looking around, and he certainly had a different view of that situation. And turned around and walked off. And that's all that happened. Nobody interfered with him. Nobody changed him. I think eventually with this technology as it develops, as we engineer the mind levels, that is a doable. It isn't doable right now. But 10 years from now, it can be a doable. 20 years, certainly, and that's about all we got. I'm trying to live to the year 2000. I'm not worried about the Y2K problem. That'll sort itself out. Starts about April, I guess, of next year. But I'm worried, do we make it to June of 1999? But the thing is a doable. But unless we can get the feet of our scientists on the path we have been laying down here, nobody is ever going to do it. Now, the other guys, under the name of a science branch called psychoenergetics, are engineering the mind directly. And they're well alone. You remember Captain Button? 810, suddenly blew off at 110-degree angle, flew across a whole state, flew all around, circled. Captain Button was thrown into an instant hypnagogic state. What is hypnagogic? You're awake and dreaming at the same time. In the late 60s, Lisitzin said, we have this technology now where we can insert material in the mind, pictures, thoughts, words, sounds. We can control whether or not it rises to the conscious. We can keep it all unconscious, or we can control what arises to the conscious. We can control that perception. And this guy was the guy that had all the medical information of the Soviet Union under his control. So they've had this, the old LIDAR machine, which Ross 80 tested, is 50s technology, and it could already put a mammal, any mammal, cat, man, whatever, into a catatonic trance. They used it, I think, on our prisoners of war, I'm pretty sure, in Korea. It was very effective, could not be resisted when it was used. It was an early prototype. The versions today have a great deal more distance. They reach through the earth, and they can zero in on one person. That doesn't mean they're using it on you or me or anything like that. They use it for a test, and there's a very special reason for that test. And I'm not here to discuss that. I'm just telling you they have the capability to engineer the mind directly. Captain Svoboda, less than 2 months later, that was very simple. Simply orient which way is, disorient which way is up, which way is down, flip it in a mind. The most experienced night pilot we had was a lady pilot, Captain Svoboda, an EA-10, pulling out of an attack, practice attack on the target. If there's one person in the United States who knew not to look back and to climb out from the target, rise out of the target area, it was Svoboda. But what they say happened is he looked back at the target and steered the plane over and flew into the ground and crashed. That's not what happened at all. What happened is suddenly she realized she was diving instead of climbing, and she immediately climbed, put it into climb, which unfortunately really was a dive. She instantly pushed the stick over, banged in the ground, and blew into smithereens. They always test in pairs, and that was the second test. Now, the end result of that program, the end purpose of that program, is to engineer the collective human unconscious, but not the way I just talked about. They have no consideration for free will. They don't want it. They don't desire it. They want an ant society. And if they get there first, we will become an ant society as an interesting excursion. But we will still destroy ourselves not long thereafter, because the people who are not part of the ants but controlling them will still fight with each other and use all the tools, and they'll still destroy the whole works. So their way won't work, even with the ant society. But I personally do not wish to become part of an ant society. Frankly, I'd rather die as a free American. But anyway, these are the things that we now face. Let's suppose we get smart and we make it. For one time in our life, we actually get smart. We quit beating one another's brains out. We think about the whole human species. We see what's got to be done, and we decide to do it. And we do it. And we miss this ant society and our total destruction after that. So now we're not going to destroy ourselves. What's going to happen? It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Now I got the good news, like the Cajun says. I got good news for you. Every signal that we put into this biosphere of ours carries within it the internal structure of the internal electrodynamics. If I were to put it in the old Eastern school ways, I would say the kundalini of the American, of the human species is being slowly raised. If I were to put it into physics terms, I would say we are slowly, slowly, slowly being linked in our ability to perceive. We actually are approaching the stage where it is not love your brother and sister, but it is be your brother and sister and be yourself also. It's not a either or, it's both and. You don't lose your independence or your personality. You just also see and understand the other person's independence and personality, free and equal. It has nothing to do with male and female. And it occurs for man, woman, and child. Now, as that rises, one can show, and including mathematically, that also what I would call, for want of a better term, the psychokinetic ability of the human species, and the individual human will also rise. Suddenly you won't need the priori machine. You won't need the automobile. You won't need an anti-gravity spaceship. If you wish to be somewhere, think and you're there. We become, as in, I'm speaking now in my own religious terms, and I'm not trying to work this on you. You sort this out any way you want to, because how you visualize this depends on your own belief, your own philosophy, your own creed. But from where I'm coming from, the way I see it is this. We have a promise that we are made in God's image. I believe that promise will come true. Thank you very much. I'm deeply touched. I don't know what to say. I can only add one thing to that. My purpose is to communicate, particularly to the younger people, a vision, if you will. Now, I'm not a guru, nor do I intend to be a guru, nor do I want to be a guru, nor will I ever become a guru. I want everybody free and independent on their own. But I think that we have to look to the younger scientists and the younger members of our community if we're ever going to see this done. And so the real purpose is to provide information. I don't want them to have to go back over the same torturous 30 years I've gone. I want them to start where I'm at, find any errors in what I'm doing, go ahead with it, improve it, and do it. I don't think I personally will ever see it done, but I would like for it to be done. No, I don't have a web page. I have an email address. I don't mind giving you that. It's Soliton at bellsouth.net. And if you send me something, don't send me a long, 20-mile long list. I can answer one question, but I'm very limited in time. And, I continue to get all kinds of things with 50 questions that would take me the next 2 years' research to answer, and I simply can't do that. A simple question or direct question I can answer fairly straightforward and try to do that as much as I can. In the immediate future, my plans are to do two things. Write the book on priori, get it on the internet, get it published. Finish that. Goal is by the end of the year, more realistically by the end of the first quarter of next year. Second goal is to produce the energy book, get all the stuff on energy with all the derivations and everything else in there, all the reference and everything else, get that published, get that on the internet. That's my two main goals for the next year. So that's really where we're at right now. The basic thing is I want the information out. And I don't care who does the priori thing. I want to see it done. I don't care who does the over-unity energy thing. I want to see it done. I'm in several projects myself. I'm in one with Scott McKee, for example, that has great promise. I have not seen the machine work, but I did write the original provisional patent application for it, and I can tell you this. It's got some brilliant things in it. It's not my invention. If it can be made to work, it is a great promise. This does not substitute for the fact that we have to build it, see that it works, and we have to have an independent certified test. And at that point, you got something. And I say this to everybody else that's working on free energy. Please take this direction. The direction for you to go is for you to get it working, test it to your satisfaction, immediately go to a government test certified laboratory, get a contract with them for them to test IEEE and NIST standards. Get a certified test that's good in court, good in the government, and it's good in the scientific community. And nobody's going to question you if you've got that test certificate. That's the way to go. Don't engage in stock scams. I could have gotten rich a long time ago if I just wanted to sell stock and fool everybody, and I could be the monkey on the string that does the clever dodge and dog and pony show to fool everybody while we take their money. They would do it legally, sure. And I would get rich, sure. That's not the way I'm wired together. We have a stock corporation. We will not accept investment. Did you ever hear that statement before? Now, we will accept investment when we have a working model with a certified test. We will accept an initial investment where you pay only for the test after we think we've got the working model and it's met all our tests. But before that, we will not accept investment. Because whatever else is ever said to me, whether I succeed or fail, it will not go down in history that I deceived my fellow person and ripped them off of their hard-earned money. That's not going to happen. Not as long as I own the majority of shares, which I do. Next, excuse me.
In your research, have you ever come across anyone connected to the TRW Corporation, the Electromagnetic Environmental Effects Division?
No. Never have. That doesn't mean that they're not doing something. It just means I personally haven't run across them. I stay very limited in the people that I interact with. I try to interact with people like inventors who I find out, you know, you can have a discussion scientifically with, who do have their feet on what I consider to be the right path. They're intending to bring this thing in and to prove it in advance with a certified test. Now, those kind of people I enjoy working with. I don't enjoy working with the folks who turn around and sue me. That's no fun at all, and I refuse to work with them. I refuse to work with somebody who has no desire to demonstrate a test by an independent facility. That violates the scientific method. Science depends on replication. Verification by replication, that's a basic scientific method. If you will not accept that, even if it goes against you, that's the scientific method. You learn if you're wrong. There's no fault in failing. The fault is in failing blatantly and then continuing to preach that you have succeeded and milk everybody else out of their hard-earned dollars. That's wrong. I'm not going to do that. So that's the sort of guidelines that we work under. They're not good guidelines. I'm not going to get rich doing this until we succeed. But we expect to succeed eventually, slowly. And I don't care, again, who does it. Scott may be the first. Patterson may be the first. He's certainly got a working device. His is verified. It's been tested 3 times independently by independent test agents. Met the test every time. There's no question. It's real. Several other devices have been independently tested. The anti-Stokes emission phenomena is for real. The Lewandi stuff has all been tested. It's for real. So we do have a whole category of things here that are for real. Now, whatever happens after shaping it up and going for power systems, that remains to be seen. But the basic necessary threshold has been passed by these folks who have invented these various things and have had them tested and verified. So I'm very hopeful that we will have free energy devices. Whether I'm part of it or not doesn't matter that much. You know, personally, I would like to be part of it. But if it doesn't happen, that's okay. We'll still get cheap, clean energy. And we're going to have it. It's going to happen. I guess I got a time for a question or two, yes? Okay, there's a lot of information on the Internet on hypoxia. You'll have to work at it. For some reason, they got it a little bit hard to run across and get it downloaded and all, but it's on there. And then there, it will give you some references, the work you get there, to some standard textbooks. And they bury this in obscure textbooks and obscure articles, but it's well known in the literature. And you can check it out, and you'll find that hypoxia is involved in almost every human disease. Not quite all of them, but most of them it's involved in. Obviously, if you break your arm, that's different from hypoxia. But if it's a debilitating disease, I assure you hypoxia is involved. Some scientists even make it stronger than that. They say all of them involve hypoxia. You better treat the hypoxia first. But it's standard, and you can find it out. They just made it. Nobody writes a book and hands you a book on everything you always wanted to know about hypoxia. They should, but they haven't done that. Yes, Gene.
Thank you very much.
It's come to the end of our time, and I'm thinking that in terms of summation, we have learned about free energy, we've learned about healing, we've learned about artificial structures on Mars being authentic. We've learned a lot at this conference, And I feel that we all have a mission now to make life work so that we won't become part of that ant colony. And I admonish all of us, you know, who don't want to do this, to change their mind and to work for the good of the whole. I really would like to invite all of our guest speakers up here to the platform so that we can give them the appropriate closing applause, please. We need Tom Van Flandern. Why don't you stand up? Because we must close. They must take the cameras down. I don't know. Where's Tom Van Flandern? He's missing. Here he comes.
Come on down.
So why don't you stand up and give him a rousing send-off. Thank you so very much for sharing your vast knowledge with our audience. It's been a privilege indeed.
.5 calculation over lunch. He is without the coordinates. We will have to get them to you and put them on the internet. Here, before you all leave, what I said yesterday about if this was a nice idea and we had a wonderful weekend and we all went home and nothing changed, it would be a failure. It's very important that we talk briefly, we think briefly about what do we do next. If what you have seen here has moved you in some direction, problem, solution, then obviously there has to be an action item. You have to decide now to do something. What can you do? That's where the internet comes in. There is a video which is going to be produced from this conference. What you do is you get the video and you make copies and you provide it to your friends, you provide it to your congressmen, senators, you send it to the White House, you send it to Sam Donaldson. Sam Donaldson, for instance, beat cancer. I'm going to try personally to connect Sam Donaldson and Tom Bearden. If Sam Donaldson gets to see the priori data, Sam Donaldson is a fighter. Sam Donaldson is an honest guy. Sam Donaldson cannot be bought. Sam Donaldson will find out what happened to priori and provide Ted Koppel with information. This is the way it goes. What we need from you is the political backup. So let me recommend an action item. Make a promise to yourself and to us tonight that you are going to drop a note to Sam Donaldson regarding Tom Bearden and the priori technology and its ability to literally cure cancer with documented references in the literature. Pre-sensitize Sam Donaldson. So when I call and Tom and I go see him, he says, oh, I know about that. A lot of people wrote to me about that. That is the single most critical thing you can do, and it's really, really easy. If you do that, we can do the rest.